Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Attention all theater lovers, this Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, all theater lovers, both out and proud and on the DL. Welcome back to Broadway Breakdown, a podcast discussing the history and legacy of American theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. This series is called The Big Move, and it is covering shows that had so much success off Broadway, they just had to transfer to the Great White Way and try some luck over there. I am your host, Matt Koplik, the least famous and most opinionated of the Broadway podcast hosts, and with me today are Broadway podcast co-hosts. They are brothers. They are theater fans. They are the moment. The moment is them. One might say they've done the thing and continue to do the thing. Please welcome the co-hosts of Drama, Connor and Dylan McDowell. Hello, gentlemen.
Drama.
Drama. Hello. I'm Dylan.
I am Connor. For your listeners who've never heard our voices before, I'm the one that sounds more annoying.
And I'm a little bit raspy. I like to think, at least.
Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for coming on, guys. So, first of all, I was telling you before we recorded, I've been listening to some of your podcast today, and it's lovely. I have one complaint. For a podcast called Drama, you're not bringing me enough drama. You're far too even-tempered. You're far too kind and considerate. You ask your guest where you're meeting them that moment, like emotionally and mentally, if like what headspace they're in. You are far too kind and considerate. I don't like it. Your podcast should be called Nice People.
Wow. This is, you must be the only one star review that we've gotten on Apple Podcasts before. That is a really great critique. You know, when we started the podcast in 2019, I think we wanted to be a little bit Page Six-y. Mm-hmm. And then we realized how small the theater community is and how people are so afraid of
anything.
Stepping on any toes, you know?
And anything.
The closest example to someone who steps on toes we've learned, other than the filthy foul-mouthed Matt here, is this sweaty fella on TikTok. And we see the stir that sort of caused. You know what I mean? So at heart, Connor and I are just kind Midwestern boys, but we'd like to think that drama is more than just, you know, gossip or tea. It's also life, honey.
Yeah, absolutely. You know you are famous when you get your first one-star review on Apple, because it's no longer like friends and family. It's someone who found you, was not a fan, and you're still standing here. So bravo. I think this might be the first time we're hearing Connor and Dylan dip their toes into some of the, for lack of a better term, cuntiness of Broadway. We're not Page Six on this podcast. We don't really like to tell secrets super out of school. The only tea we tend to spill is the stuff that's like relatively well known in the community. Maybe some fans may not know, but like everyone in the community knows it's out there. And you know, we opinionated. But on that note, first of all, I have two questions. One is for you, one's for me. Both of you have asked your guests, what is their Ring of Keys moment? I don't know what your Ring of Keys moment is. And for the listeners of my podcast who don't listen to drama, what does that mean?
Oh my God. So my answer changes. We always say, like, do you have a moment or moments? And that's because I find that I still have them all the time. But if I were to really boil it down to when I realized, like, I love the community aspect. I love celebrity. I love Disney Channel original movies, because it's like this, there was a network of artists that they would, you know, maybe Brenda Song was starring in a detective, you know, film, but also she was playing London Tipton on The Suite Life.
I'm sorry. Did Brenda Song do Get a Clue with Lindsay Lohan? Is she the friend in that? Or is that, are you talking about a different detective movie?
I actually don't know what I wasn't specifically referencing like a specific Brenda Song.
She might have been the friend in that.
She might have been. Connor, you cannot say details like that willy-nilly, because these things exist in the DCOM universe.
I think I just really want Brenda Song to play a detective in, you know, she was in Get a Clue.
She was?
She had to have been,
yeah.
She had to be. Why else would I have said that?
I don't know. First of all, we don't know. I think she was. She feels like the kind of sidekick to Lindsay Lohan at that time. Like
She was in it.
That, we love this. We love this.
I love this. But no, I loved this. And then you're watching Disney Channel. So you're not only watching them star in movies, have songs on the CDs that come out on Radio Disney, on the website, on you know, DisneyChannel.com, where you can play the video games inspired by the shows, but also, you're watching Disney and you see little, like, we're all just chilling behind the scenes vibes, you know, like they're recording songs for charity, you know, doing summer games where they're competing in the Olympics. So I really feel like DCOM culture skyrocketed me into loving the idea of like a community, a theater community, a troupe, this something you could be connected to, which of course the musicals were my favorite.
Yeah.
High School Musical, Cheetah Girls. So I feel like if I were to really pin it back to like
Cheetah Girls with Miss Susan Egan.
Period.
On period. Sorry, and I interrupted you. Finish your statement.
Oh, I just feel like if I were really to think back to like the youngest I was when I was.
Wait, was, you know, Susan Egan in the Cheetah Girls?
Wasn't she? No, she was Gotta Kick It Up. Never mind.
Gotta Kick It Up. She was Miss Bartlett and Gotta Kick It Up.
Thank you, Dylan. That was homophobia on my part. Connor, continue.
I love that. No, I feel like that's where it began for me, because then I was like, okay, Ashley Tisdale's slang is Sharpay, but she's very grounded and humble as a Maddie behind the candy counter in Suite Life. So I would say that's it for me, but I was always interested in celebrity and the arts and drama, of course. So Dylan, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, even before that, like Disney movies on VHS were huge for us. You know, I think every young theater gay acted out the scenes while the movie was playing for their family. You know, everyone loves to be like, when I was a kid, they actually filmed me singing along with Aladdin or whatever it is. That is real. That did happen. It's not as unique as you might think it is, but it is. I'm going to go with a different one that I have been thinking about lately for my Ring of Keys, which, for those who don't know, in Fun Home, it's when you realize maybe your identity, you identify with something. On our show, we talk about maybe your love of the arts or theater and identifying yourself within that passion. And I think it was the movie Batman and Robin for multiple reasons, but it had Uma Thurman as Poison Ivy. And it was this draggy performance of geek chick turned super sexual villain. And she was mysterious and she was wearing these incredible outfits and she had unreal lines and her delivery was camp of everything. And I think that campy movie really helped kind of sharpen my sensibility for what I like and go for. I'm a huge drag person. Like, I don't do drag, but I love drag. I love the arts. I love theater. I love, you know, some of my favorite musicals include things like Hairspray, where there's drag components, or Kinky Boots. And so I think that was a moment where I was like, ooh, I love this. What else is there? And I can kind of trace back now looking at this. You know, it all started with Uma, I suppose.
I will say Uma Thurman in Batman and Robin is similar to me as Gina Gershon in Showgirls. Of two women who know exactly what movie they're in and are the only ones who come out of that thing alive, because they know exactly how to mediate their performance to the temperature of the film. I love both
That's
those
great.
Answers. Thank you
Thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you. What's yours?
The one that my family likes to talk about, I really have no memory of. It is Disney, surprise, surprise. When I was 3 or 4, I was a very hyper energetic child. I couldn't sit still. I cried a lot. I still cry a lot, but for different reasons. Mm. And when we were in Florida visiting my grandparents, my parents took all of us to see Beauty and the Beast on Ice. And my grandfather was like, oh, great. Matt can't sit still for 5 minutes. He'll be gone by intermission. But supposedly, the moment it began, I was just like hooked. And I sat still and I was completely silent. And that's when my parents, I was 3 because Beauty and the Beast on Broadway was the year later. And my parents were like, that was when we knew that there wasn't necessarily something like up with you. You just like, you needed something that you connected with. And clearly this was it. I like that you mentioned sort of like things that re-trigger your love of the arts and the community. Because I've had, I will say, and we'll talk about it as we get into this show, which we haven't announced yet, but as anyone who's clicked on the episode link knows, they know what show we're talking about. There are times as you get further down the rabbit hole of the thing you love and you get closer to seeing how the sausage gets made, it's easy to fall out of love with it a lot, and it just, it happens, and sometimes things will kind of re-trigger your love for it. And I would say the last two things that really did it for me was freshman year of college, when I, all my listeners are going to take a shot here, when I rediscovered the 94 Carousel recording, and just I was like, oh, this show sounds incredible. And I watched it like in center. I was like, oh, this is the best thing I've ever seen. And this is now my favorite musical forever. And then the second one, ironically enough, was seeing Fun Home on Broadway after seeing it to the public, where I was like, oh, this was a 10 out of 10. And then I see it on Broadway and I'm like, oh, this is an 11 out of 10. And I went and saw it 5 more times.
Oh, I love both of those examples. 94, yeah. That was Audra, right?
Audra was 94. Yeah, she was okay. Carrie Pippridge. And remember this name, gents, because it's going to come back to us later. Sally Murphy was our Julie Jordan. Now, on that note, okay. Connor, Dylan, what show are we talking about today?
Well, our listeners will not be surprised at all that the show that we wanted to bring to you is Spring Awakening, which is a ring of keys from myself and my brother, I think, for sure.
Yeah.
Came at the right time. We were, you know, 13, 14 when we discovered it. And those were our new Disney Channel original stars. I mean, we were all about them. And interestingly enough, all of them had these robust careers that we could follow throughout, and even to as recently revisiting the material last year in the documentary. So I think Spring Awakening changed theater forever. And it changed my life forever. So I'm super thrilled that we get to break it down.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah, it's yeah, we'll absolutely break it down and we'll discuss the legacy and the history of all of it. Before we do that, let's take a quick break.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar.
Yeah.
You're the top. You're a Coolidge dollar.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And we're back. I'm so glad I did that now, because if I didn't do it now, I would forget about it for an hour. And I have to do two of them. So you remind me in like an hour, I got to do another one.
Our friend Robbie Roselle told us to remind you, so...
I will definitely have to take a bathroom break at some point because I only drink constantly. Not alcohol.
No, that's fine. I'm currently drinking alcohol right now, so I don't appreciate that shade, Connor. But also, Dylan and I can talk while you go pee. You're not special.
Yeah.
There's two.
I wasn't going to leave when I peed.
Well, we're talking about the right show for all this kind of talk, honey. Piss play on a podcast. Must be talking about Spring Awakening. So y'all were 13, 14 when the original production came out. That's what you're telling me? Okay.
That is true.
We were I think we were 12, because it's 2006, right?
It opened on Broadway in the winter of 2006, yeah.
2006, okay. So we discovered it a little late in the spring.
Mm-hmm. Your Spring Awakening was in the spring. Got it. Spring of 2007, then, like a few months. Okay.
We discovered July of 2007, the morning we were leaving for our family vacation to New York City to see Beauty and the Beast starring Annalise Vanderpool. So we got a little Disney DCOM connections here. And I was on MySpace.com, you know, just doing some last minute, what's going to happen when we're in New York this week? Mm-hmm. And I found the MySpace page for Spring Awakening, and it was red and black. It was sexy. And I saw boys in schoolboy uniforms, which is, you know, kind of hot. You know, closeted me. It was like, what's going on here? And of course, it was completely sold out. It had just won the Tony. So we saw a Beauty and the Beast and Hairspray that trip. But the next summer, we went back and saw it just as the original cast was sort of phasing out. And we saw like the first replacement cast kind of. But I digress.
Well, first of all, Dylan, was your nickname in high school Receipts? Because you just have all the receipts. You just know all of it.
His memory is insane.
Yes, it is.
Meanwhile,
it is.
I don't remember what we even talked about 10 minutes ago. So,
well, I was listening to the Glick episode for preparation for this episode. I was like, let's hear what a spring. Yeah, I do my homework, Dylan. I did graduate from college on time and on budget, despite what the rest of my family thought was going to happen.
On budget. So you do have receipts as well, my friend.
They're all paid off. That said, listening to Glick, I believe it's you, Dylan, who you are very good at knowing what played in what theater. That's your brain.
It's one of my favorite games.
I'm absolutely the same. So we can let's do some challenges later. But
bonus content.
I was a few years older than you guys, not that much older, not like grandpa here, but I was 16 when the show was at the Atlantic and moved to Broadway. And I remember, I was definitely like, I had my, you know, finger on the pulse of Broadway at the time. I was a city kid. All my friends were theater kids. So like we all were seeing everything. And at the time that Spring Awakening was announced to come to Broadway, the only things I remember were my friend Emily had seen it at the Atlantic. And there was no real buzz among theater kids about it other than just like, oh, this thing that was off Broadway, it's coming to Broadway. Who's seen it? Because it was like all the adults were the ones who made it like a big sold out hit at the Atlantic because Duncan Sheik and, you know, the reviews and all that. It did not take off with the kids until Broadway. And I remember Emily saying like, it's really good. I'm not sure how it's going to go, which they talk about in the documentary. And I knew Skylar from, you know, years prior from doing theater with him. And so for a lot of us, it was like, oh, Skylar's going to be on Broadway. That's cool. And then the other thing was there was a moment where no one knew who was going to come to Broadway because Jonathan Groff had just gotten cast as, I think, Jesus in Godspell at Paper Mill. And Lea Michele had gotten cast as Eponine for the first revival of Les Mis. And the conversation was, well, who's going to replace them for Broadway? Because, I mean, you don't turn down those jobs.
Right.
And then both of them turned down those jobs to do Spring Awakening, which was like very big news. It's the second time a leading lady in a Michael Mayer musical has turned down playing Eponine to be in a Michael Mayer musical. Do you know who the other leading lady was?
Yes, it was. It was the role ultimately ended up going to Celia Keenan-Bolger.
For Eponine, yes. But the first, this is not that revival. I'm talking about the original Les Mis. Someone was supposed to go into the Broadway production of Les Mis for like a year or so as Eponine. And she turned it down to go into a Michael Mayer musical that was having an out-of-town tryout at La Jolla.
I have no idea.
Miss Sutton Foster.
Thoroughly.
Wow.
Thoroughly. Yeah. She wasn't, and as we all know, she wasn't even playing the lead. She was understudying the lead. So, ladies and germs, let this be a lesson to all of you. If you get offered the chance to play Eponine and then at the same time get a chance to be in a Michael Mayer musical, even if you're like the fourth swing to the left, take the Mayer musical. It's going to be good for you. You shut down. No disrespect to Miss Eponine. Tenardier. Eponine Tenardier, if you're nasty. But
not her surname.
No one calls her by her surname. And I'm like, Mademoiselle Tenardier, if you're nasty. Let's call her what she is. But yes, I remember that was sort of the big tea about that was everyone thought Leah was crazy for turning down a sure thing with Les Mis when everyone's like, yeah. Spring Awakening, that thing's going to be gone by January. And they stuck it out. They had a very rough go of their first like 6 months. They sort of hinted on this in the documentary, but they didn't really kind of explain that. Like they opened, I think, in November of 06, and the Tonys were not until June of 07. So they had about 7 months where it was like they were really kind of going by the skin of their teeth and just like praying that the Tonys would work out for them. And it did. Spoiler alert. It did. Dylan.
In a very, very busy year, though. I mean, it was a crazy season.
Yeah. Well, yes, it was a crazy season. And we will also sort of get into my Tony drama of this year. I have a narrative, gents, of tending to not root for the musical that's going to win Best Musical, not by design. I'm always sort of rooting for the show that I feel like no one else is rooting for. And it kind of started with the 04 season because I loved Wicked. I was a burgeoning Gaben. And so I loved Wicked. I thought Avenue Q was delightful, but I had just seen Carolina Change and it blew my mind. I was like, I think I want this one. Didn't happen. Mm. The following year, Piazza. I was like, I want Piazza. If not Piazza, then Spelling Bee. If not Spelling Bee, then Dirty Brown Scoundrels. And guess what wins?
Those are Jersey Boys?
No, that was the following year. The year of Piazza.
Oh, Spamalot.
Spamalot won, which is not a bad musical, but it was the worst of the four.
I know. I always forget that Spelling Bee didn't win.
It didn't. It won Book, which is fun.
Okay. The wealth was kind of spread.
Yeah, it was Spelling Bee won Book, Piazza won Score, Spamalot won Musical, which is so odd. The following year was Jersey Boys v. Drowsy Chaperone. Team Chaperone, obvi. We love Sutton Foster's Cooter Slam. Like, that's I'm pretty sure that woman has created more gay men than any gay man in the world. Like,
yeah, no, I think you're right.
Yeah, she has been a lot of our own Ring of Keys moments. Then for Spring Awakening year, I was Team Grey Gardens, and I think I was the only teenager at the time who was a theater kid who was Team Grey Gardens. Because when I tell you that everyone else, and I mean everyone else, was Spring Awakening, it was like with such a fervor that I almost lost friends that year.
Wow.
Yeah. And I wasn't anti-Spring Awakening.
She's different.
She's different.
Yeah.
Now, Connor, Dylan, for those who live under a rock or who are uncultured, what is Spring Awakening about? What's the plot? Who is she?
Well, she's a young girl in, 1892 Germany, basically. Not only a young girl, but maybe a group of young boys and girls who are living in this repressed, pre-war society. But it's based on a play written by Frank Wedekind, who was, very prolific of his time. And I think it ended up getting banned and different things like that. But it was sort of stayed within the zeitgeist as this revealing piece. And it was adapted by Duncan Sheik and Steven Sater in the late 90s. And it's these kids who basically are going through their adolescence, puberty, some might even say, and confronting all of the different things that start to happen to you, whether it be, an identity type crisis or, your body is changing, your mind is developing, and the way that they intermingle with each other and the adults that sort of shape the society that they're in. And it's all scored by contemporary rock and roll / pop music, which creates a bit of a tension between this sort of classic book meets this modern music. And it won every single Best Musical award it could possibly win in 2007.
Connor, rebuttal?
Dylan dropped the mic, but I will say I think it's the only musical ever where there's someone masturbating for the entirety of a song that's a pop up-tempo.
The entirety of the song, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, the entirety, for sure. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think we can probably name three or four where it's like a verse.
They came too soon in those. I mean, Georg,
that's a very specific wording, Connor. Very specific wording.
Hanschen really went for it. He really... he was edging for the entirety of that number. But no, for sure, Dylan nailed it. Dylan, I don't know how you did that.
Oh. He did a wonderful job. Would we call it edging, or he's just constantly interrupted by his cock-blocking father?
That too.
Yeah, I was sort of looking into the play itself, because have you, either of you, read the original play or
never?
No. Although I think we bought it for one of us got it for the other for like a birthday or Christmas, because we were so obsessed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we needed everything.
I don't know if we ever really got through the text, you know.
Yeah. It's well, and you know, with all these foreign plays that get translated, the translation changes based on who does it. It is an odd play. In the same way that, like, and I hate to, you know, bring it back to all the things I love, but like to mirror it with like Carousel and Lilium, right? Like, I know people think of Spring Awakening the musical as sort of an odd duck, and she is. And, you know, very few musicals I would argue like objectively perfect. We can always find things to acknowledge and we shall in a very constructive way. But reading the original play earlier this week, I have to give Steven Sater some credit, because the original play is odd. It's extraordinarily bleak. He makes a couple of changes for the better for a musical, I should say. The play opens with Venla in her like little schoolgirl doll
dress. Her kindergarten dress, as her mother says.
Yep. It gives me very Suri and 30 Rock vibes when Tina Fey tells Suri,
very
like,
much.
She's like, yeah, like you need to wear like this like giant cardigan or whatever. And Suri's like, I can make this hot. And she basically like turns it into a bra of some sort. That's Venla's like, oh yes, the dress that fit me when I was 10, I'm wearing it now as a 14-year-old, so it barely covers my vagina. that scene opens the original play, but then it goes into basically Venla and her mom. She says to her mom, like, you ever think about death? And then it just goes into the next scene. The whole scene about like the stork and how do babies get made, that's way later. I think that's like end of act one. And yeah, a whole lot of other stuff. The character of Anna of the four-girl group is not in the original play. It's just Marta, Taya, and Venla. Ilsa, of course, comes in later. The Melchior Venla storyline is way rougher. Right. Yeah, I don't know if you guys have looked into this part, but spoiler alert. How does Act One of the musical Spring Awakening end? Connor, you take this one.
They make love in a hayloft while their friends push a swing around, and they sing about how they believe that there's love in heaven, ultimately. Yeah,
ultimately that. And of the two of them, who actually knows what it is that they're doing?
The boy.
The boy, Melchior. Melchior understands what sex is and how it works and the consequences of doing it, whereas Venla has absolutely no idea. In the musical, all she knows is that it feels good. She likes it. And she does eventually relent, because Melchior is like, why should we let ourselves not do this just because people say it's wrong? In the play, we hate to, you know, say this word too often, but like in the play, it's fully a rape. Whereas in the musical, it's a little more gray area, because like while she is enjoying it, she doesn't actually know what it is that they're doing. And that is its own form of sexual abuse. In the play, she fully is just like, she's so confused and doesn't know what's happening. And the last line of act two of the play is Melchior don't, and so
right,
which like I don't think that Dylan, how do you say the name again, Frank Vedekind, yes, thank you. I don't think Vedekind was saying like, isn't this romantic? He was being like, the whole point of the play is children have urges, mankind is awful, and we're all toxic, and you know, we're just meat bags roaming the earth. The way the play ends, it has, you know, Melchior coming to the gravesite. Spoiler alert, some people die. With the character of Moritz, who kills himself when his grades are poor and his dad's like, I'll disown you. And then Venla dies of a botched abortion, because when you aren't practicing a procedure like that safely, you're most likely going to die. Remember that, guys. We're not political on this podcast, but we are at the same time. Because what Venla doesn't realize is when you have sex with Jonathan Groff and you let him finish inside you, babies happen. Just if you're Leah Michelle, not if you're me. I've tried many times with Jake Groff and it just hasn't happened yet. I keep waiting.
You said it before I could, Matt. You beat me to the punch.
Oh, I'm sorry. Would you like the punch?
It's interesting to talk about complex characters like Melchior, because I wonder if Spring Awakening came out today, mm-hmm. if audiences would be responding to specifically that story point in a way that's, they're calling it too offensive or cancelable or whatever, because ultimately, you know, he is like a 14-year-old boy who does know what sex is and what it can lead to. And he does have sex with, you know, Vendla. And I'm not saying I condone that act, but I am saying I do like in art when there are characters who are making mistakes, imperfect, being complicated, making the audience think this is wrong and or this is right or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I wonder, you know, when Spring Awakening came out in 2006, it would have been a totally different conversation, which I'm sure still happened. But I imagine now audiences would probably be like, no, there's a rape in that show, a deliberate rape from our hero. And I think audiences would probably think of it differently. Don't you guys think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. But, well, first of all, I my ultimate annoyance with quote unquote theater criticism is when people say something is cringe. I don't think that's an actual criticism. We have to discuss sort of the intention of a moment. And again, you know, you're talking to someone whose favorite musical is Carousel. And so, you know, there are, I would argue, a show that's ultimately about how, like, people who are unhappy and are drowning make really messy, awful decisions and keep making bad decisions, and it blows up in all their faces. And then it's like, well, how do you put yourself back together after everything's fallen apart? And Spring Awakening is a little bit the same way. And ironically, Connor, with what you bring up, like, the show was controversial when it first came out in the early 1900s, and the musical is controversial as well. And it still remains controversial. And it's ironic because the whole theme of the show is like, well, if we don't talk about these things, they're still going to happen. Just it's going to happen with much more dire consequences. So we at least have to talk about it.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean,
for sure.
And the musical, I think, is a little more empathetic to the characters and Melchior in particular. And like, you can't have Jonathan Groff as your lead and have him just be like a toxic rapist. You know, I mean, you could.
Right.
That's we in some ways we love this casting, but as Melchior is like our hero, it's a little more gray area because there's a love in the musical, whereas the play there isn't much love. He's a bit more of kind of a blowhard kid, and the play ends not with Vendla and Moritz's ghosts, but with Moritz's ghost with his head blown off. So he's carrying his head, and you better believe they make jokes about it. And basically, Moritz is like, being dead is amazing. I love it so much more than being alive. Come be dead with me, Melchior. And then a dude who we never know what his name is, he's just known as the Masked Man, comes on stage. Because, you know, any masked man in a cemetery in the middle of the night who's talking to a 14-year-old boy is instantly trustworthy.
Chills. Creepy love chills. It.
It's like, this should be a horror movie. He basically tells Melchior, he's like, don't listen to the ghost boy whose head is in his hands for some reason. He's like, come with me. I will tell you all the things about adulthood so you won't be struggling anymore. And Melchior is like, the fuck is this? And Moritz goes, go with him. I was lying. Being dead's kind of awful. I just wanted you to be with me. And that's how the play ends. And
interesting.
Yeah. Whereas I think the musical, I think, again, Sater's like, so we're cutting the Masked Man. It's like, what if we brought back Vendla? Because, you know, we need to bring up back our leading lady and we put a song here. And it's a lot more hopeful. Whereas the play, it's a little kind of foreboding. That's not the right word, but it sounds right.
Interesting.
And I think they remove any element of Moritz trying to convince Melchior to take his own life. Because him and Vendla appearing, it is, they each sort of are like on his shoulders, but they're not devil and angel, in my opinion. They're both kind of saying there's more to learn, there's more to experience in life.
Yeah. The thing that the documentary said that I appreciated, because I never really thought of it this way, in the cemetery scene towards the end, Melchior, you know, has escaped from reform school and he's going to, you know, run off with Vendla, so he thinks, before he realizes that she has died. And in his despair, Moritz's ghost comes out and sings the Those You've Known reprise. And Melchior's instinct is, while thinking of Moritz, great, you had the right idea, I'm going to take my own life. And as Dylan said, like, it's not Moritz telling him to do it. It's just the memory of Moritz triggers that for Melchior. As soon as he's about to do it, Venla's ghost appears and she starts to sing. And the difference between the two is Moritz took his own life. Vendla did not choose to die. And it reminds Melchior in his own way, like, you still have the gift of being alive. Don't just take it for granted and take it away.
Mm-hmm.
there's, and unlike Moritz, who truly felt like there was nothing left to live for, like Melchior, it's almost as if him killing himself was going to be like a political act. In fact, you know what? I'm going to go on I'm going to go on a limb out here, and bear with me.
We're in.
I think Melchior is a great stand-in for a lot of our modern day brethren who are incredibly smart and insightful and empathetic, but are more activists in theory than in human action. Like, can think about mankind as a general concept and analyze it from afar, but can't really understand the nitty gritty, messy emotional stuff, which Connor was mentioning earlier about sort of like what makes the show not cancelable. And I think Melchior is sort of like, if Melchior were watching Spring Awakening on stage, he'd be like, no, this is cancelable. Act one Melchior would be saying this. By the end of the show, I think Melchior realizes that the musical Spring Awakening is not cancelable. And I think in the movie version, it ends with him writing the play Spring Awakening.
Oh, of course it does. You know, he's been journaling throughout the whole thing. You know, it's going to turn into his manifesto.
Exactly. He's Joe March and the play is Little Women.
Actually, that's interesting.
The movie that's been circling the drain for years, that who knows if it will ever actually happen. But
yeah, we need, well, in fairness to the play, the one director who was circling it was Mick G. And much as I love the first Charlie's Angels, that's not a director that necessarily gets a blank check to do what he wants.
I love the second Charlie's Angels, aka Charlie's Angels Full Throttle.
Why?
It has everything you could possibly need in any film.
We're not talking about Spring Awakening for at least five more minutes until both of you make this case. Take it away,
unreal.
Atticus Finch.
There is not a better film.
Mm-hmm. There's girl power. There's cameos. There's sexuality that's owned, not exploited.
There's a fallen angel.
Yeah, Pink is in it. Demi Moore is in it. Drew Barrymore, the Olsen twins. You know, you've got Shia LaBeouf. Is his career about to take off?
It's camp. It's
It's about sisterhood. And you have Jen Aniston's ex with the gray sweatpants.
Justin Theroux doing an Irish accent.
Mm-hmm. But you got hot men. You have incredible stunts. You have John Cleese. Misinterpreting innuendos.
Well paced. It's camp.
There's a whole musical sequence at a strip club to the Pink Panther theme.
An end credit sequence that calls back to scenes seen and not seen in the film.
To really any way you want it by up. Journey.
I mean, it's got everything.
Except for, like, you know,
a cohesive plot.
Perhaps.
They're going for the rings. They have to get the rings.
They also have Melissa McCarthy. I mean, it's so good. Bernie Mac.
To be fair, I have not seen the film in about 18 years. The thing I remember is what's his face from Back to the Future, the creepy man, the one who plays Michael J. Fox's dad in Back to the Future, with his hair thing. Like, loves to pull the hair of women and sniff it, which, you know,
Crispin Glover, I think, is the actor's name.
Crispin Glover, yes. And I've been there. I've done the hair pull out and sniff it because, you know, you only live once.
Mm-hmm. I did hear that about you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. But there's a moment with him and Drew Barrymore where, like, they almost kiss and connect. And then I think he gets murdered, right?
He does.
And Drew Barrymore lets out a scream. Like, she is
they scream
Claire
at
Danes.
Each other. Yeah,
she's Claire Danes in Romeo plus Juliet, and he's Leo in Romeo plus Juliet. And I'm like, girl, you just started to like him 4 seconds ago.
Right.
I just remember seeing that being like, I'm sorry, what movie are we watching? I will say, in its defense, it is the rise of Demi Moore, and she, speaking of an actress who knows the film she is in and rising to the challenge, she does the damn thing.
She does. Mm-hmm. She absolutely does. I love that movie. We should rewatch.
And last cameo, Carrie Fisher is in it as Mother Superior. Anyways, we'll move on.
Speaking Wait, what? Of, yes, I don't remember that at all.
Yes, it's a blink or you miss it cameo. It's actually like a 5-minute sequence. It's mostly narration about the creepy thin man's past. Because when he was a young boy, he went to a nunnery and they raised him, and she's the Mother Superior there.
And they were anti-sex, which is why he's always pulling the hair out of women.
I don't know. They don't really explain why.
It's an inexplicable.
Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, back to Spring Awakening.
Well, I was going to say, because Creepy Thin Man sounds like one of the children from Spring Awakening when things don't go right for them as they grow older. It's the bit of living. With nothing going on. what is a song that you keep coming back to in this show?
Okay. The one that I, and this is a deep cut because it's not this part, the part of it is not on the cast album. It is the final version of the Song of Purple Summer. Mm-hmm. It's the beginning solo for Ilsa. She has an extended line. And it's, I think, the thesis statement of the show. It's about listening to children. It's Children Will Listen vibes, but it's basically acknowledging, like, hey, kids are just figuring all this shit out. They need to be guided. They also need to have the freedom to explore. They have, you know, they have their whole lives ahead of them, hopefully. And one day, all of these bad things that have happened to them, or these bad thoughts, these hard things, will not be so hard. And they will get to experience the peace and beauty of life that lays ahead of them. The Song of Purple Summer, you know.
You got me weepy.
And she, so, and that's what I love this, that part of the song. I don't know why. I mean, I loved when Steffi D would sing it on the Spring Awakening First National Tour that we saw, I think, 5 times. But I love that it ends with Ilsa because, well, she's the only character that kind of survives at the end, hypothetically. But also, she's a dream. In a way, she's a legend.
There are some who still live at the end of that show.
Yeah.
But I think she is the one who has probably been through the most, mm-hmm. even though a lot of it happens before the play and a lot of it off stage. But she's sort of the ultimate survivor of the show.
For sure. And even her presence in the show.
She's like the most together.
And her presence in the show, I love this theory that maybe she is or isn't there in many of the scenes. I mean, in The Dark I Know Well, we know that she's not with Marta when Ilsa's singing. No. And when she appears to Moritz, is it a figment of his imagination? He, of course, had heard about her, but is she really there? And I kind of love the idea. They never look at each other in the direction.
That's how Michael Mayer directed it for that reason.
So was she there? And I love that she's kind of this legend who's maybe gotten through the hard bits. And the Song of Purple Summer itself is such a beautiful finale. It really, because you do go through all this darkness, but I love that you see all the kids on stage and the doors open up and Melchior comes back through and he's ready to dive into the rest of his life on a hopeful note. And I just think it's a beautiful song, even though I have no idea what a purple summer is. No one actually does.
Yeah, no one does.
Well, okay. So, Dylan, don't think we're forgetting about you. You're coming up next, girl.
Okay.
I took to Instagram last night as I was watching the documentary in prep and then watching the boot of the OBC again, which, by the way, for anyone who hasn't watched the documentary, I have some notes, but overall it is a very effective documentary. The number one highlight, and something that I'm not, it's a double-edged sword where I'm like, I don't think this is absolutely necessary to the story we're telling. However, I can't imagine my life anymore not knowing this information, is the moment when Lea Michele and Jonathan Groff talk about the day she showed him her vagina because he asked. And it's specifically because Jay Groff was like, I didn't quite know where the clitoris was.
We actually asked Chris Rodriguez about it when she came back to do our show in November. Mm-hmm. And we were like, had you heard this story before? Like, did they talk? Did you know this happened? And she goes, no, I did not know that they did this. But was I surprised that it happened? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I had a feeling. But what's funny is, and as we learned in the doc, Jonathan didn't come out of the closet until a month after Spring Awakening ended. But he's like, you know, fully in his early 20s, telling his BFF, Lea, I don't know what a vagina looks like, but she's supposed to be under the assumption that he's not gay. I don't know. It's like a funny moment, but I had plenty of those when I was closeted too. So I'm not.
Jonathan in Spring Awakening was a bit of a glass closet situation. And this, we'll weave in and out of this rather than do sections. Welcome to the podcast. We have no structure. But so I was, you know, again, I was a theater kid in the city and I eventually actually did like the first open call that Spring Awakening did when the show was open and might have gotten called back once or twice. It's fine. Didn't book, but it's okay. Oh. We're not bitter. We ain't bitter. But at the time that the show was first on Broadway and it was still the OBC, there were one or two cast members who I did not know but had one degree of separation from through teachers or friends or whatnot. And again, this is sort of like the double-edged sort of seeing, you know, inside the room where it happens, you hear some things that are super awesome and some things are like questionable. And one person in the cast was like, oh yeah, Jonathan and I like go back to his apartment all the time, hang out with his quote-unquote roommate and do Carol Channing impressions all day long. And the whole, and it's, you know, because everyone's being respectful, no one's like, Jonathan, what are you doing? But everyone's just kind of looking at each other being like, okay, so whenever he's ready, he'll tell us. Like, it was very much, everyone knew, absolutely everybody knew. It's not that he was in denial, it's just that he wasn't saying anything. And in his, and again, in his defense, it was a time where, like, when you came out as an actor, that's all you got cast to do. And he was right, because when he did eventually, like, come out even more publicly, because there was a moment in 2009 when the Hair Revival was on Broadway and Jonathan Groff and Gavin Creel were on the steps of the Capitol marching for marriage equality.
Right.
And everyone was like, excuse me, is Jonathan Groff out of the closet now? And then it became this whole thing. Like, there was an article about how, like, well, gay actors can't play straight because we all know they're gay. And they, like, listed Jonathan as the number one issue. My point being, Purple Summer, I did a poll and I said, everyone, what the fuck does Purple Summer mean? Does anyone know what these lyrics mean? And there were three options. Yes, I do know, and I will DM you. The second one was, LOL, no, something about corn and shit. And then the third one was, who cares? It's a bop, and lyrics are stupid. Now, 48% said they had no idea, thought it was about corn. 45% said, it's a bop, who cares? And only 7% said they absolutely knew. That said, many of the people who said they had no idea were people who have been in Spring Awakening, either on Broadway or on the national tour. Again, not naming names. But one person who has been in Spring Awakening professionally in one of the two major productions on Broadway, again, not saying who, sent me a message and he said, do you actually want to know? And I said, yes, please. This wasn't a joke. And this is what he said. Purple Summer is a flower. Didn't know that. According to Steven Sater, Purple Summer represents the time of maturation, a time when the fields will yield crops and the horses bear foals again. It is the time when the painful spring of adolescence reaches the maturity of summer. Similar to what Connor was saying, a perfect coda to the show that we have just watched. A poetic, it gets better, if you will. I had a few people DM me similar things. My only thing was, they're like, you know, how the painful hardships of winter will melt away to a beautiful summer. And I didn't say this to them because I love my fans, but I did have a moment where I was like, you know that winter doesn't go into summer, yes? There is a whole season in between. One might even say the title of the show we are discussing. It's essentially, it gets better. And I think in the documentary, Sater talks about, like, purple being sort of like the color of a bruise. So you're bruised, but you're going to heal and you'll move on. And
yes.
Yeah. It's all freshman lit and we're not mad about it. Yeah. Dylan.
Yeah.
Song you come back to all the time.
You know, this is a mostly no skips album for me. And I have to say, it changes constantly, but I will say The Guilty Ones is probably my favorite song. I'm such a ballad queen. I just love, I think Leah's voice has never sounded better than on that album. It's so gentle. It's this gentle part of her voice. Mm-hmm. And I just think it really captures so much of the show. And it was a song that was later added, but it is just so beautiful to me. And the staging is incredible. In the original staging that was on Broadway, it's this act two opener sort of interlaced with a church sermon. And it's them kind of grappling with, what did we just do? Should we feel terrible? But it's a way from, you know, from what I've learned over the years, it was a way for the writers to communicate that it wasn't rape and that they both feel good about what happened. And, you know, even though their bodies might be guilty for committing this sin, that their minds and hearts are still comfortable with what happened because maybe it was love.
Yeah.
Or something new.
Yeah. It's much more of a gray area. There's the political element of knowledge that makes it tricky, but it is consensual in a lot of ways. Guilty Ones, first of all, that's the nickname for Spring Awakening fans, as we know.
Absolutely.
They're in the room with us now.
Yeah, all of the Guilty Ones are here, everyone?
Yes, yeah. In a way.
In a way. That was perhaps one of the only songs. So when I saw it on the B-Way, with the original cast, no big deal. I'm just old and I lived in the city. It's fine. But
you city kids.
Us city kids, I'm telling you. That was the only number when I saw it pretty soon after it opened to like a 70% full Eugene O'Neill Theater. And there were a couple of I went with my grandmother, by the way. God bless Nanny for this is the same woman who took me to Piazza and Carolina Change. So she like
oh, good woman.
Cultured. She is a cultured fuck. She loved it. I remember she loved it so much. And I was like, it's cute. But the people around us, they couldn't get on board with the choreography, I remember. So like they liked the song Touch Me, but they didn't like the whole like boob circling thing. And the only number that they actually all audibly started to laugh at was Guilty Ones. And I don't know why. I think it was just the visual of Lea Michele having just been plowed out of her mind and Jonathan Groff asking if she, you know, if she's too wobbly or whatever. And her immediate reaction is to pull out a microphone. I understood it. I got the vocabulary, especially because at that point we'd seen it done so many times. But everyone else around me was like, girl, let's talk. And she was like, you know, about to sing a song. It's that joke that a lot of people think about musicals that I assume Schmigadoon loves to do. I've never actually watched it, but the whole like, well, why don't you just talk to me? Well, I'd much rather sing. Mm-hmm. But it is a beautiful song. I think the score's only crime musically is when Miss Michelle is belting Ease. It is with a bunch of other people. I need more Lea Michele belted Ease on her own. She sounds great, and the harmonies in Mama Who Bore Me Her Priest are iconic. But I'm like, I'm sorry. I need some Fs solo for Miss Michele, please.
That's the thing. The crime to me is whispering, which it has never sat right with me as a... I mean, it sort of serves as an 11 o'clock number, specifically for Vendla, because there isn't really an 11 o'clock number otherwise. I think Those You've Known is the finale, and then Song of Purple Summer is the sort of postscript epilogue. And whispering, although the plot moves forward in a series of sort of sequences throughout the song, it is not necessarily a bop. It's not, you know, it doesn't necessarily, she doesn't really peak at any point throughout the song. It's just more so a park and bark about everything she's gone through throughout the show.
100%. And I wanted
maybe some belting.
Something. If she had a better final moment alive, I think that maybe Lea would have been nominated for a Tony.
Well, yeah, you know what? Fuck it. Let's get into it. I don't care. This is a natural progression. Let's talk about these Tonys for a second.
Yes.
This was what we might call a rather stacked leading actress year.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I want to just tell everyone this now, because this is going to come up in conversation for next week's episode. We love to undermine a frontrunner. We love to question a sure thing. For example, when Hamilton was out, the night of the Tonys, a number of people I was with who were just like, but like, what if Hamilton doesn't win? Like, what if so many people are just sure it's going to win that they were like, oh, I don't know, I'll vote for Shuffle Along. Meanwhile, I was like, I would love nothing more. I love Hamilton, but I was also like, I want Shuffle Along to get recognition. But that was the year where it was Christine Ebersole or die. There was no one else. There was absolutely no one else. But I don't know if either of you were brave enough to look at the message boards yet this year. The message boards loved to say, I don't know. There's Donna Murphy in Love Music. I don't know. There's Audra and 110 in The Shade. And it's like, okay, we've got Donna Murphy in Love Music, which, you know, I saw and I still don't remember it. We've got Audra in 110 in The Shade. Babe did an aerial flip with no hands. Iconic. However, it is a roundabout revival. It's a little difficult to win in those. Then we had Laura Bell Bundy, Legally Blonde, once again iconic. The only other place where Lea could have really gotten in was to replace Deborah Monk in Curtains. Now, here is where this is a little tricky. There was another actress that year who was not nominated. Do we know who it was?
I do. Well, there was two, actually, in my opinion. One was Kristen Chenoweth for The Apple Tree.
Yes. And the other was?
And the other was... Mary Poppins, which Ashley Brown. Yeah.
Yes.
This is a stacked theater season.
Absolutely. People are talking about this like leading actress in a musical lineup for this year. And I'm like, oh, honey, you haven't seen nothing yet. This is 5 inches compared to the 12 inch dick that 2007 was. Ashley Brown, I remember, was considered a bit of a disappointment only because all of us had heard Laura Michelle Kelly on the London cast recording, who had
won the Olivier.
Sure did. And rightfully so, because that bitch sings the house down on that score. Like, it sounds so fucking easy, caramel melted all over my face. I'm just like, sing me to my death, Laura Michelle Kelly. And Ashley, I remember everyone thought was a little too, not harsh, but like hard, like just a little too Broadway. It wasn't quite British enough. It wasn't quite effervescent.
I think Belter when I think Ashley Brown. I don't necessarily think light and airy Julie Andrews, Laura Michelle Kelly.
Yes, and it, not her fault. She made the role work for her, but it wasn't the natural fit that it should have been. But still, leading lady in a title role of a major hit, Disney, was a musical nominee. And then we had Chenoweth, who was the sole reason that Appletree came to Broadway from Encores, and like one of the hardest roles in musical theater, one of the most like shadow of the original looming over Barbara Harris in the Appletree. So for Chenoweth not to get in, I'm like, I hear you, Dylan. And like, I do think, I agree with you as well, Connor. Like, if Venla had one more, like, before I go moment, I think Leah would have had a shot. But it's a little hard to say for sure when even Chenoweth couldn't get in.
But yeah. Let me plead for something.
Lead away, baby.
I don't know. Okay. Vendla is technically the leading female performance in the show, but I would say she's got as much stage time as Moritz and maybe less to do vocally even than Moritz, because she doesn't have Touch Me solos. She doesn't have Bitch, you know, there are things. I don't even think she sings. Yeah. So I wonder if they could have figured out a way to put Vendla in featured actress.
It would be category fraud.
But if you're looking at who has stage time on this and she's in it just as much as Moritz, why not? It's Melchior's story.
Well, then on that note, let us look at featured actress in a musical, shall we? We have the winner, Mary Louise Wilson in Grey Gardens, who was never not going to win. We have Orfeu in Legally Blonde.
Amazing.
My winner.
Oh, well, you're young. We have Rebecca Luker in Mary Poppins, which I remember at the time everyone was like, oh, okay. No one was mad about it, but it was a little odd.
Well, she got to sing Being Mrs. Banks. I mean, and that's just, you know.
It felt right. No one was mad about it, but it felt more like, Rebecca Luker, we like you. We don't necessarily love your show. So it was Orfeu, Mary Louise Wilson, Rebecca Luker, I think Karen Ziemba for Curtains, I remember she had a major dance piece in Act One of Curtains that just was like reminding us all that she was Karen Ziemba. And then who was our fifth?
Charlotte Dambois. Yeah.
In Chorus Line. Yeah. Which that is technically where Cassie should be. Talk about category fraud. Donna McKechnie.
Right. Because Donna McKechnie won for lead.
Sure did. Sure did.
You know. But then we wouldn't have gotten the incredible win for Emily Gilmore in featured back then for...
Absolutely. And Kelly Bishop deserved that Tony.
For Sheila, right? It's Sheila?
Mm-hmm. Sheila Bryant. Okay. Sheila Rosemary Bryant, which she really hates.
Right, of course.
Yes.
Your brain is amazing.
Thank you. I had no friends growing up. So,
but Leah. I don't know. Was Leah good in the show? I didn't get to see her. So I don't know.
That's the other thing. I remember at the time, so Leo, like, she was on the posters with Jay Groff, right? Like, it was them. They were the marketing of the show, and they were the face of the show for a very long time. So there was sort of a feeling of Leah, Jonathan, and John Gallagher Jr. were, like, the trio. Mm-hmm. And I know she got a Drama Desk nomination, but it still kind of felt like everyone was really just talking about the boys more than they were talking about her in terms of performances. And
even though she bared her boobies. Wow, that's really something.
Listen, Kelly O'Hara did the same thing, and she didn't get nominated for Dracula, so sometimes you don't show your chesticles if you want to be taken seriously.
But Ivy Lynn did it in the Bombshell musical on Smash, and ultimately, spoiler alert, won the Tony. Yes. So,
but
anyway.
But she did have to live in the Smash multiverse, and I don't know if that's really a win.
Tough to digest that one, Matt. Tough.
Yes.
Tough,
a
tough,
world tough. Where Catherine McPhee is considered special. I don't know if I want to live in that world.
Mama who bore me, mama who gave me no way to handle things, who made me so sad. Mama the weeping, mama the angel.
Anywho, watching the bootleg again, I don't know if I necessarily think Leah was great in the show. Her acting has improved a lot since Spring Awakening. Have you seen her in The Girl That Is Funny?
We have.
She gave the performance of the season in Funny Girl.
Oh, yeah. No, she's incredible in the show.
And by season, I mean, yeah, it's a new season and she's still giving, you know?
Any season. So this is, okay, this is another part we can talk about. And we'll tread lightly because we know people. We don't want to put anyone on blast. We don't want to share any information that no one consented to sharing. But, you know,
sure.
Leah has had a lot of backlash against her for a lot of things that it came out of the woodwork about her behavior over the last 20-ish years. A lot of which, honestly, I was not there for, but I have confirmation from many sources. True. I love people learning and growing and becoming better. And I like to think that that's what's happening with her. So I did go into the show being like, okay, Leah, let's see. And then by the end of like 20 minutes into act one, I was like, this is the performance of the year. This is the performance of the last 5 years. But there were issues with the original company of Spring Awakening. And I'm not gonna spill too much tea. All I'll say is there is something. Immediate success is really difficult to grapple with, especially if you're young. And that cast was young. And while the show did not take off commercially for a while, it found its fan base very early. And that fan base was very passionate. And I hate to use this word because I find it overused, but it was rather toxic.
Yeah.
As many fandoms can be. But that was a fandom similar to the Rent fandom, where it was like, understudies were considered lesser than, or some understudies were considered better than. So if somebody was off and the understudy was on, it was either you like, oh, everyone rushed to see the show because blank is out and we all know that they're terrible, go see the understudy who like should be bumped up anyway, or and like very vocal about it, sending these kind of things to the cast. And then the cast, again, like, and this is like one of my notes about the documentary, Graf Soss was like, you know, it's crazy. The success didn't go to any of our heads. I'm like, Graf Soss, I'm sure it didn't go to your head because you are.
I clocked that moment too, Matt. I clocked it too. I was like, he is blissfully ignoring. It had to.
It did.
I don't care what they're saying. It had to. And I don't blame them for it or judge them for it. They were the toast of the town.
They were.
And a lot of them, you know what, still are. That's the crazy part.
We don't begrudge them on it now because we're all older, we're all wiser, and we look back. To quote Katya, if you're not looking back on the previous year embarrassed, you're doing it wrong.
And you know, it, Leah's journey is a lot like Melchior's. You know, we make mistakes, we stumble, we fumble, we might mistreat others, allegedly. But at the end of the day, don't we all deserve a redemption and to enter that purple summer? So
exactly. Well, and again, it's braver and more impressive to grow from a toxic place and become a healthier person. And if we don't allow people the room to do that, then who knows what damage we're doing. And this isn't even like to put Leah on blast. I'm really talking about like the show at large. And it's not just the original company. It was the replacements. It was the national tour. And again, not going to speak out of school, but I am friendly with a lot of people involved with that show. And because I've been known to be opinionated and not afraid to say things, a lot of them will come to me and be like, you cannot say it's me, but I have tea for you. I'm not sharing any of it because I do think like the moment I share any of it, people will be like, oh, I know exactly who that is.
So were you telling your Spring Awakening affiliated, you know, friends like, hey, I'm doing essay on the pod. What should I stay away from or what should I say? Do you have any fun scoop for me? Did you reach out to sort of your circle for that?
I didn't even have to. When I posted on my story yesterday about the documentary, they all fucking flooded my DMs. And I was like, do you want anything to share? And they're like, not to share, but I'll tell you. And some of them were a little more guarded. Some of them fully said stuff. But like, you know, that show, it was a blessing to everyone involved with it, right? It launched so many careers. It opened doors and amazing things. But there is a little bit of a Vaseline over the lens in that documentary, especially with Graf. And I think because with Graf, like, he is truly an angel on this earth and like maybe the one person in all of Broadway that you will not find a single person in this world who has a bad interaction with him. Even the nicest person you can think of, there's like a disgruntled usher or a merch person or someone at the stage or it's like, oh, they caught them on a bad day. And it's like, Cher Renee Scott wouldn't sign my playbill because she had a head cold, that bitch. Like, it's even something as simple as that. Jay Groff is the one person where you're never gonna hear that. But it is a little like, I'm sure it wasn't bad for you, babe, but like, it all it takes is one little poke. And the only reason I bring this up is because it's ironic connecting it to Spring Awakening, which is the whole, we don't like to talk about the things that make us uncomfortable, the things that feel unpleasant, but you kind of have to if you're going to make it through, right?
Right. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And you know, for whatever happened back then, I think that when they reunited, it was, you know, last year, 2 years ago for the documentary, they were adults now. You know, they'd lived whole lives, and many of them were still in high school. I mean, a few of them were still in high school when Spring Awakening was even on Broadway. And, you know, of that main group, I have to believe that, you know, they all had to come together on a certain common ground to do that reunion. You see pictures of a lot of them being moms now and a lot of them still being friends and things like that. There's people you don't see in those photos that maybe were more out of the spotlight, like those Springs and understudies and people like that who, you know, obviously weren't getting the huge attention at the stage door or things, or maybe fan letters, but certainly everyone had their fan, you know, someone was everyone's, how to put this? Got that last bit. Someone was someone else's favorite at all times. You know what I mean? Everyone had their faves in the cast. Yeah. And so I definitely think no one was probably ignored, but I know there are certain people that we've even had on our show who talk about being in the first replacement cast of Spring Awakening and the fans being horrible to them and saying things like, you weren't as good as so-and-so, or we miss the way that Remy Zakin would sing this line or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's just like, you know, people don't know how to talk. And I think that the Guilty Ones environment created this insane virtual stage door and community that even I, at a young age, was like, oh, you don't walk up to someone at a stage door and say, so where were you on your vacation for 2 weeks? Or, oh, we heard that you, you know, are, you know, gluten-free, or, you know, like weird things like that. It's like all the lines were sort of worn down because of the Guilty Ones. And I don't know.
Yeah. So in the Rent episode, we kind of talked about this, like that was the show where fandom changed. Broadway fandom changed. And there was, and I think part of that is because of the internet, right? Where it was no longer just, oh, you liked the show and you saw it when you could. It was, now I got to know everything about the people in the show. Now I have like ownership of the material and the roles and the company members. And that just kind of got worse and worse. And Spring Awakening, I feel like, was sort of the crystallization of stage door fandom culture as we know it today. As Dylan was saying, you know, of, it's not just you have to have an actor in the show you like. It's, oh, I need to know everything about them. I need to know what their favorite candy is. I want to know who they're dating. I want to send them gifts. And again, I don't love yucking anyone's yum. Depending on the yum. If your yum is Finding Neverland, spoiler alert, I will absolutely yuck it for you. But
I have heard you talk about this on your podcast before.
That's how you know she listens, kids.
You hate it.
I do really hate it. There are shows that I don't think are very good, but I recognize that effort was made. And it's so difficult to make a show, right? It takes so much time and effort, and amazingly talented people have made bad shows in the past. People rarely try to make a bad show by design. I get angry if a show isn't good and I feel like no actual effort was put in. If I feel like it was done by committee, and it was purely done to, like, become profitable. And Finding Neverland is the number one example of the last, like, 20 years I can think of where, like, I sat there and I went, no one tried to make this a good musical. They just tried to make it a marketable musical. And I was furious. But the glitter storm was great. Laura Michelle Kelly died like a pro.
Well, I think that's what's cool about Spring Awakening is that it's already a great musical, and the subsequent productions have all been so received positively, but like the messaging is still getting out there, but in such inventive ways. I mean, the 2015 revival, where they incorporated American Sign Language into it, and they tweaked it and added multiple actors playing different parts. And I think that's the sign of a great revival on a great show telling the same story, but in an interesting way that we just saw a couple years ago, but now we're thinking about it newly. And I think that's what's so cool about Spring Awakening and it's the life it's had since 2006.
Yeah, I think I have. So one of my issues with the show is in my older cynical age, because I've gotten older and I've gotten more cynical. Much as I love it, I think it's musically speaking, I agree with Dylan. I think it's pretty much musically a no skip. And
to that, wait, really quick to that point, the one song that is a bop that I did, I want to just say this really quick.
Yes.
Touch Me, Slay.
Sure.
Absolutely incredible. The vocals, the moment, the emotion, the swell, the choreography, the everything. It is
the lighting moments.
I think it's back to back with My Junk, right?
Yeah.
Basically, there's a book scene in between, but yeah.
Yeah. Musically speaking, they're back to back. Those two numbers, I think, they're actually pretty similar in terms of how they build with the whole ensemble, but in very different ways. And I am a big fan of the vocal arrangements for both of them and how they build. Lyrically speaking, I think my favorite song is Bitch of Living. It has my favorite lyric in the show is Moritz's beginning one where he's singing about the angel. Give me that hand, please, and the itch you can't control. I'll teach you how to handle all the magic in your soul. Oh, we'll work that. Sorry, no. A sadness in your soul. We'll work that silver magic. Then we'll aim it at the wall. She said, love may make you blind, kid, but I wouldn't mind at all. Now, I love that lyric for many ways. The way that it very subtly discusses masturbation and where Moritz chooses to finish. But also, love may make you blind. Do we know what that's referring to?
Wouldn't they say that if you masturbated or things like that, your hands would grow hair on them, or you might go blind, or things might happen to you. You know, there's all these different things.
Wait, it's not to the Netflix reality dating competition Love is Blind?
It was Steven Sater warning us in the past. He's like, this is what's coming in the future.
Soothsayer.
Soothsayer. And then that's why the original title for Song of Purple Summer was actually called Heartstopper. And Sater is like, no, I'm going to let them be surprised by that one.
It gets better. I love it.
It do. I love that lyric, though. I think it's so clever and cheeky. And I know also it had a lot of criticisms at the time for the forced rhymes or false rhymes, which I get. And some of them I do agree with. Every now and then there's just one. I'm like, there's a word that actually rhymes, like just like within like an inch that you could have grabbed. But for the most part, I feel like it's, you know, paralleling pop music, right? Where it's like it's the rhyme is the vowel, not the actual word. They're rhyming. It's matching vowel sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Like T-Swift loves to do that. It's always like, oh, yeah, yes, oh, right.
She does. You're talking to two Swifties as well. So
wait, I feel bad for interrupting you earlier to say like Touch Me is amazing, blah, blah, blah. But you were saying that as you've gotten older and more cynical, how you feel about the show.
There's so much about the show that I find very beautiful. I find sometimes, and this is just, it's not necessarily the fault of the show, but rather that it just is catnip for this kind of style of performing. It's very easy to make Spring Awakening self-indulgent because it is a very hard-on-sleeve, emotional show. And it's also very abstract. And so there's different ways to present it and different ways to act it. And, you know, we've all performed. We're all performers. We know performers. Nobody loves to showcase that they're feeling something more than a performer. You know, there may be an actor who I saw in a Broadway revival of a play a few years back in an acclaimed revival that they did not get nominated in. And they did something that gave me such Spring Awakening vibes, but it was done earnestly. And it was the hand to face, down to neck, down to chest, down to stomach of just like, I am feeling so much right now. And
who was this in what revival? Oh no, barf. Oh, yeah,
he didn't mean it sexually, but it's more like, oh, the emotion.
Yeah.
The emotions are so overwhelming. They have manifested in my hand and my hand must caress my whole body. And
oh, that is such like lazy acting, in my opinion.
1000%. But that shit is so easy to do in Spring Awakening. And so what I love about the original production that I've talked about this on the podcast many years back. So y'all will have to go back like 5 years to find this. I did not love the last revival, not because of the ASL, which I thought was so well incorporated and really did bring a new vibe out to the show and new messaging, which I loved. It was just on a technical musical theater level, I found it sometimes indulgent in the sense that Michael Mayer knew not to linger too often on too many moments, because if you do, you're going to lose your audience in the esotericism of the show. It's like, we got to keep things going. For example, when Venla as Leah Michelle runs off stage to get her a bobo, they don't dwell on it very much, because in something like that, like, it's the heat of the moment. It's like, there's no time to lose. We got to get this kid out of you. And so it's very frightening. And then I'll never forget in the revival, because it was like the third time they did this in a row in like 10 minutes, when they throw Venla off for the abortion, everything stops and her mom like walks backstage and everyone's looking at her being like, you've just sent your daughter to her grave, which would be moving if they hadn't done it like three times prior in act two alone. And I would, and that was just me.
I forgot about this.
Yeah. And I just remember sitting there being like, see, like, I need, this is where, and Michael Arden is a very good director. And I want to say that now, because everything he's done since Spring Awakening. And I don't think he did a bad job of Spring Awakening. There was a lot I liked in it. But then once on the sideline, I was like, oh, you figured your shit out. Like, you're no longer running into the issues that I had before. And then Christmas Carol was so divine. And I'm looking forward to Parade. But that was something I was like, someone needed to sit there with Michael and be like, okay, in order for this moment to land on a musical theater chemical level, where it's just like, add the ammonium, add the sulfur, whatever. I don't go to school for chemistry. But, you know, where it's like, it's balancing. Like, okay, for this moment to land, we need to cut the previous two.
Mm, totally. Yeah. I think, you know, what you were mentioning about sort of an indulgent, it lending itself to indulgence. I wonder if when, you know, a production is so memorable in its original staging, that it lends to people always trying to replicate that. And I think that that's an example being the choreography. And the idea of gestures has been something that I think the show has had. I mean, then obviously lending itself to American Sign Language, you know, it's, which is all gestures and facial expressions. But the idea of, I've never seen a production since that hasn't had Vendla touching her body, like doing the swirl around her breasts, standing on a chair. I've seen that in every single, and I used to seek out productions of Spring Awakening to see, you know, in Ohio locally all the time. My boyfriend just did it a year ago. And every single time that happens, you see that. And then Touch Me involves a lot of that similar movement. And I mean, Bill T. Jones obviously was very smart with what he did there, because it's about, you know, exploring oneself and mm-hmm. doing it through gestures. But I think it's really, I don't know. I want us to find new ways of doing that as the show lives on and goes forward.
Absolutely.
Because it looks very imitation.
Yeah, it might take a while, just because it's one of those things that has become so ingrained in the DNA, similar mm-hmm. like a Fosse show or a Jerome Robbins show. And there's something magical to that, of a work being so vital to a show's identity. But, you know, someone will come along who's never seen Spring Awakening before and find something new with it. In the same way, you know, I'm looking, what if someone did like the most literal production of all time, and it just took place in the actual woods, and there's trees everywhere and concrete walls and all the good stuff.
Yeah.
Before I forget, we have to take another break.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar.
Mm-hmm.
You're the top.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
And we're back. Connor has went to the John, the Lou, if you will, while he's away. Dylan, let's gab.
Yeah.
What? So we talked about songs. What are moments in the show that really land with you, either comedic or dramatic or a specific character?
I really love the levity, despite it being really deep, a lot of what Moritz is going through. I love the comedy that his character also brings. Mm-hmm. I think specifically the scene right before Touch Me, when he's explaining, you know, these this wet dream that he had the night before, or maybe it was a couple nights before, but then he read the essay that Melchior had written for him.
Yeah.
And it's funny, but it's also, because I think it's also relatable to many people, but it's also, you know, dark, because it's really driving him. I mean, it's driving him to fail because he can't sleep, because he's afraid to dream, you know, for fear of this woman appearing to him and all of that. And so I think that those moments where it keeps it a little bit light is why, you know, it really helps balance it, because otherwise it could be very dark, like you mentioned about the original,
yeah,
the original piece. And I think, you know, also the adult characters really help break it up in those different ways, especially if they really want to make them each memorable. Like, you know, if the instructor is different than the mother, or and so forth.
Yeah,
I don't know. The you mentioned the masked man earlier in the original production, and that was something that really, really fascinated me. And they had it up until the Atlantic production. And it was a character played by Michael Cerveris. And he had songs. He was sort of lurking throughout the show in the background, as opposed to just appearing at the very end. And I think that that character could in some ways still remain in the show if the adult man also played that role. But I don't know. They obviously had a good reason for removing the character for the Venla experience, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's Venla coming back in the end of the show. It's similar to vibes of like in Titanic, how like all the passengers who died get to come back and sing one more time. There's just something very fulfilling.
Les Mis,
yeah. It's Les Mis is the, you know, OG of doing that, but of it, you know, it's the difference between the show running for a year or two and then running for forever. It's the difference between Spring Awakening, the musical, maybe lasting to January and then having a 2-year run of, we were talking about the Masked Man and Venla, Connor.
Are we back on?
What?
We're back on.
We were talking while you were away.
Okay, it's cool.
We don't need you. We don't need a man, but yeah, there's something very emotionally fulfilling about watching Venla getting a chance to come back and sing one more time, even if it's as a ghost. Musically, totally. Musically it's very fulfilling. And I mean, I like the idea that they had the Masked Man originally and, you know, tried to incorporate him more. But I think, honestly, part of it, I mean, I would have to sit down with Sater and ask, like, whose idea it was to cut him completely. Because I think also there's the, we don't want to get rid of Cerveris. He's Michael Cerveris.
Right.
But, you know, I just, even in the original play, I just don't think that the Masked Man works. It's such a forced and very convenient character to bring on at the last second and be like, you're struggling here, let me tell you all the things no one's told you before, which makes sense in a way, because, you know, one of the major themes of the play is all the adults will not say anything, and here comes some random adult who clearly is not really part of the society, probably has been exiled for reasons we'll never know, but because he doesn't adhere to the rules and to everyone's sort of suppressed mentality, he's willing to teach Melchior the ways of the world. And it's a little pat. I like the idea that Melchior, there's hope for Melchior simply just from the human connection of it all. Because you were talking, Dylan, about the booklet, the essay that he writes for Moritz to learn about human anatomy and sexuality. And it kind of connects back to what I was talking about, how Melchior is someone who really doesn't understand that, like, the world is messier than just his ideas. And even if his ideology is politically correct, he's not enforcing it in a way that is empathetic. Yes, knowledge is power. Moritz should know about all these things, but he has to look at his friend and, like, understand that his friend is not mentally and emotionally in a place to have his whole world shattered by this knowledge. The adults try to pin Moritz's suicide on Melchior's essay. And it's obviously that's not what does it, but I don't think it helps Moritz in any way to learn about all this, because when he talks to Melchior about it and they go through Touch Me, like, Moritz leaves the stage and we don't really ever see him in on solid ground ever again. He's always kind of rocking back and forth from that moment on. There were none, which is, first of all, talk about a goddamn bop. I fucking love that song.
So good.
It hits. I remember, like, always loving it on the cast album, but it wasn't until there was, like, this live recording that they did at some event, mm-hmm. and it's the song straight through, and John Gallagher Jr.'s vocals, the rawness, the emotion, I was like, oh no, this, in addition to having Melchior's mother in it, it's iconic as hell, mm-hmm. but the song itself stands alone as this cathartic, emotional, rock, mid-tempo song.
Yeah, no, it's great. I always felt that the original cast recording, well done as it is, really should have been a live recording, a la Six. Mm. There's an energy that you're missing from the cast recording. There's a pristineness to the vocal performances, which I enjoy because, you know, Lea Michele doesn't do rough vocals, but I wanted some of that energy from the stage, and it's a little pop album-y for me.
It's also an incomplete album because they recorded it between Atlantic and Broadway, I believe. Mm-hmm. And there's lyrical differences. Purple Summer, Touch Me has different lyrics at the beginning. The arrangement or the song order is different. Don't Do Sadness comes before Guilty Ones on the album, but in reality, it's the other way around. And so I don't know what was going on there.
Yeah.
It was just not fully, maybe they just wanted to record it and get it out there before, as soon as they could.
That's happened before, where the album gets recorded early in hopes of promoting it once the show comes out, and it did help.
SpongeBob,
like SpongeBob, like Evita, honestly. But I wish that they recorded it live. Ah, well, I'm gonna just quick lightning round for both of you in terms of these songs. "Mama Who Bore Me," immediate thought when you think of it.
Oh, it's legendary. I feel like it's one of the songs that people who don't necessarily know the show, they know the song "Mama Who Bore Me."
Mm-hmm. Now, "Mama Who Bore Me" reprise.
Slay. Mm-hmm. It's the only moment in the show that the girls get to slay, like absolutely rip, you know? Mm-hmm. They don't get to do it at all at any other point.
No.
That's so true.
I don't think any girl in the show sings above a C after "Mama Who Bore Me" reprise. I think it remains relatively low after that.
Wow.
Yeah. And none of the girls get to even speak and totally fucked. Like, they don't get to have their little, you know, mantra or whatever they get. So
yeah, it's weird. The girls are very underwritten, like especially Taya and Anna. They really don't get a whole lot other than talking about what their uncles or whatever teach them or their life philosophies about
hitting
children.
It's sort of an inverse because the boys, it's Georg, Ernst, Hanschen, and then who's the fourth
Otto.
One?
Otto.
Otto. Otto is the underwritten of the four.
Yeah.
Georg doesn't really have a ton, but he does have like two very big moments. And like we remember, like, oh, Georg, he's the one with the piano and he gets the big Touch Me solo. And then Ernst and Hanschen, obviously, like they get their scene, which is incredible. And then it's sort of the inverse the girls, where Ilsa and Marta both have moments. But Marta, honestly, after Marta's song, we don't hear much from her ever again. And Taya and Anna really don't get anything, which is a shame because, you know, there is a history of casting really strong actresses in those roles. And I'm like, I'm glad we have you to bring these characters to life, but you deserve more.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
The first, those
I do
known.
Like the scene where the girls are talking, though, and they're like, are you wearing it to Greta Brandenburg's wedding? And they're like about like there's such a wholesomeness to the way the girls talk. And maybe that's a little on the nose for how the boys and the girls talk. But I do appreciate those scenes. I especially appreciate seeing Venla in the scenes with the other girls, because otherwise it's really just her and her mother or her and Melchior. So
yes. It's good to see Venla with her peers and how she acts there. And it gives you an insight into sort of Venla's mentality throughout her life, right? Like, mm-hmm. she does what she's told. She doesn't ask. Anytime she asks questions, you know, it takes a lot of courage for her to do so. So she's not going to the wedding because Mama thought it was improper. The first, "Those You've Known."
Jay all Groff. That's known.
Oh, it's
an
all
amazing,
all
amazing. Right. "I Want" song in many ways.
It is an "I Want" song. It is. It's very Disney Brigadoon. He's not sitting on a tree stump. He's sitting in a chair, probably made from a tree, and telling the audience, "You watch me."
We watch it. We meet our anti-hero.
We really do. "Bitch of Living." Favorite part of it.
God, is this it? This can't be it. Towards the end.
Ooh, chills every time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's so good.
I always was titillated by their showering in gym class, though.
Yeah. Look so nasty.
Bobby Mailer.
Looks so nasty in those khakis. In the play, Hanschen is queer. In the musical, it feels a bit more like he's just sort of sexual. Does that make sense?
Maybe
that's just the way that the original actor played him, but it felt less like he was gay and more that he was just overly sexual. But maybe that's just how I am viewing it.
No, mm-hmm. I completely agree. Because he wants power more than anything else.
Yeah.
And you know, it's that idea that their children will ultimately become the Hitler Youth. And he's sort of this pre-Hitler Youth. You know, he's gonna grow up to raise a kid like that. You know, he's power hungry, you know?
And that's blonde.
And he takes advantage of Ernst, who is just this sweet, sort of almost invisible person up until that point.
Well, it's a similar situation to Wendla and Melchior, because Ernst does want what's going on in the scene, but Ernst doesn't have all the information. And if he had all the information, knowing that we as an audience are watching it, knowing that Hanschen's going to, you know, drop Ernst the moment that Ernst goes, you know, face down, butt up, and like, it's the truth.
Ernst is a sub bottom,
absolutely. And it's not just because that's what Gideon Glick decided to make the character, that's just how the character is written. He wants to be a pastor, for Christ's sake. But if Ernst knew that once he gives it up to Hanschen, that it's not gonna be like that ever again, he might not do it. Or maybe he would, but it has to be his choice, right? And so Hanschen does take advantage of Ernst in that respect, as someone who also, like, not that situation, but like the number of times I've made decisions not having the information, thinking I had the information, and then finding out after I've made the decision, oh, you did not tell me chapters 5 through 10. Like, you end up
with relatable.
It's very relatable. I think we all can, you know, understand that. Who is Hanschen pleasuring himself to? Do we know?
It's a portrait of Desdemona, who's, you know, from the play Othello, and she's dead. Or is it Hamlet? It's one of the two.
It's Othello.
Othello,
that's what I thought it was, because he's asking her, like, have you prayed tonight? And I was like, does he have a portrait of an actress who played Desdemona? Like, it's a very, yeah, I don't know.
You know, when you could, because Spring Awakening, we haven't mentioned this yet, but when it was staged in its original iteration on Broadway, there was on-stage seating in which the cast and the sort of ensemble sat amongst you and came in and out and switched between seats. And it was immersive in that sense, that you could be on stage if you purchased those tickets. And I remember sitting on stage and trying so hard to see the photo that Andy Mientis was holding during my junk. And it seemed like a very black and white, like blurred out, but obviously a woman. There were breasts.
Yes, he is pleasuring himself to a woman for sure. Because he says Desdemona, but I can't imagine that he's like, ah, yes, I have the headshot of the woman who played Desdemona in the local production of Hamlet. I don't, it's just all very specific. I don't, speaking of like the power thing, I don't know, like the way he talks about her, it's very dom sub and talking about her murder. It's very strange. Yeah.
Because she's dead, you know?
Yeah. Like, he's pleasuring himself to the memory of her. I don't know. I also remember in the original production, there was a blackboard at the back of the stage that listed all the numbers of the show in chalk, like, but in order.
Oh.
Yeah. Maybe I'm making that up.
You're right. No, you're right. You are right.
I'm right. Hear that,
you're
everyone?
Right,
I was
Matt.
Right. Thank you. Listen, I'm always right, but sometimes I'm just not convinced, but I am always right.
Something I loved about the set too was that they recreated what happened at the Atlantic, which is, you know, the basement of a church, I believe, or sort of like downstairs of a church. And they kind of kept that vibe. You know, the show has a lot of references to these sort of, you know, institutions, whether it be government or church or, you know, school. And that environment sort of remained with the production that made it to Broadway and then toured and whatnot. It's sort of, you know, it looks very holy, I think, in many ways, that intimate vibe that they went for.
If there was one change we would make to the show, other than giving Wendla a don't forget me Ivy Lynn moment before she dies of her abortion, what is there anything else we can think of where we like, I would want to maybe get a second pass at this moment?
That's tough, because although I do want more for the girls. I don't necessarily know if they need another number. Mm-hmm. I don't know if any of the other supporting characters need another number in general. So
I wonder if I would, much as I love Hanshin and Georg's lines in My Junk, I wonder if I would just make it the girls or focus on the girls
okay.
a bit more. I don't know. That might be like,
it could have been a scene.
Yeah. I don't know if that's like win some and then you lose some, but if I were to give them more to do, I would expand My Junk into a full on epic belt fest for the bitches. Yes.
I love that idea. Yeah. Dylan, what do you think? I mean, I think it's pretty, it's interesting because I was in preparing for this, reading about the London revival that happened in 2021 and 2022. And Dylan, it was at the Alameda.
Oh, cool.
And because Dylan asked me earlier, he was like, was it at the Alameda? And I'm like, yeah. And I read that they replaced the Guilty Ones with the song that was originally written for the show, There Once Was a Pirate, which we all may have heard, because I think Duncan Sheik did a version
of it.
It's
on Spotify. I just listened to it today. Yeah.
Did you? I don't know much about this revival, but I think that's such a fascinating choice to swap in a cut song. And there was another song that originally was in Where the Bitch of Living Is.
A Comet on Its Way.
A Comet on Its Way. Mm. They really love a metaphor in Spring Awakening.
I think that's Steven really Sater.
Sater's like, why be literal when we can talk in metaphors? Metaphors and allegories. You know that Gavin Creel had done early workshops of the show with Liam Michelle?
Yeah. Ooh, I love that connection.
Yeah, it's a great connection. I mean, a lot of people, this show was in development for many years. You mentioned sort of, you know, from what I understand, Sater found the script in the late 90s and he was sort of like a poet playwright-ish kind of moving about, and he met Duncan Sheik because they both were in a Buddhist community
and they would chant together.
Yeah, and he said to Sheik, like, we should work on this together. And I guess it wasn't until they got Mayer on as director that they really kind of went hard with it, because Sheik was like, well, I don't really write musical songs, I write rock songs. And when they brought Mayer on board, Mayer was like, yeah, no, absolutely. Like, this show needs rock music. And I think that's also what will keep the show evergreen in a lot of ways, is you have 19th century Germany mixed with early to mid 2000s indie pop rock music. And it keeps the whole thing moving. Because the music doesn't sound super dated in a way that a lot of pop music of that era does, you know?
Sure. 100%. That is such a good point. Yeah. That is such a good point.
Thank you.
I think, though, like, in looking at the track list and thinking about the show, I think it's really concise. And there's, like, not much fat there. I wouldn't change much.
No. And if you watch the boot of the original production, it clocks in a little under 2 hours without the intermission, which is a pretty tight musical. I mean, a chorus line is a little over 2 hours and intermissionless. And, you know, that's considered a pretty compact musical as well. It's not so much about like what I would add or what I would cut. I don't know. I think it's more just about like, or is there anything that I feel when the show's over that I might want a bit more of? And I think because the impact still is pretty strong at the end, the ends justify the means, but
I don't know. I think if anything, I've always felt very confused about the Melchior character, because you have someone like Jonathan Groff playing the role who is so sweet and demure in many ways. And I mean, obviously I didn't see him playing it, but I had trouble connecting him as this rebel. And that's how everyone describes Melchior throughout, but I don't necessarily think we see him do anything rebellious other than explain the facts of life to Moritz and then obviously have sex with, oh, well then again, there is the beating scene, which is like a tough, we haven't even touched upon that, which is a tough moment. But we haven't talked about either of Melchior's solos in this, The Mirror Blue Night and Left Behind, which are honestly two of my favorite songs in the show as well, just lyrically.
What do you want to talk about? Go for it.
I don't know. I think that Mirror Blue Night is interesting, that it's like this late first act sort of soliloquy for Melchior to like reflect on how he's feeling. Because it's after the beating scene and it's before the hayloft scene. And he doesn't, it's that, you know, you're saying earlier, Matt, it's like we sing because we can't speak anymore, but he's alone with his thoughts singing this, you know, ballad, but it's a very confusing lyric. I think it's one of the first ones that was actually written for the show. Beautifully written. but I don't think it necessarily clues us in as an audience how he's really feeling because the lyrics are so abstract.
Well, he has the line, it's cold in these bones, I'm a man and a child. And that's true. The fact that that's the only lyric I can think of, I think also comes to your point where that line is, I think, the crux of the song. I can't explain the rest of the song, though. But I also don't think we get that struggle from him in the writing of, you know, so many of these characters, they're going through puberty. And there's a reason why Frank Vedekind and Sater start the show with Venla wearing a dress that she once wore as a child. You know, I still feel like a kid. Why does it matter that my body is developing? What does that even mean anyway? And it's that, you know, you have these urges, these hormones, and these thoughts that really aren't saying much about you. They're just sort of part of the transitional period, you know, it's like a whole new rebooting of the system. And, you know, while that happens, there are some chromosomes that are getting rearranged, and thus you might have some weird thoughts like, who is it? Georg or Otto, who like fantasizes, has a wet dream about his mother or something like
that. Yeah, it's Otto.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Just one of those things where it's not Otto's fault. That's just how hormones work. You're going to fantasize about people that, you know, you don't actually desire. It's just what's going to happen. I think we don't necessarily see that struggle with Melchior because he's so quote unquote all knowing. His rebelliousness, yeah, it's more just his knowledge, because he's at for the act one, he's sort of being rebellious within the system because he's such a good student and everyone likes him so much. He's kind of like this double agent. They don't realize the chaos that he's causing within the system because he's succeeding so well in the system. And then it's an act two and everything goes to shit that, you know.
When they find the pamphlet and everything and he does the reformatory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when Moritz kills himself and the pamphlet does double damage because the school uses it as means to blame him for Moritz's death. And then when Venla is revealed to be pregnant, Melchior's parents find the pamphlet and go, so it's not just he was exploring, he knew exactly what he was doing and what the consequences were. We have to send we can't think of him as a child anymore. He knew.
Maybe they were right.
They kind of were right.
Yeah. You know, as we're talking about, like, it's all the boys in the show that get to have pleasure. And the only, you know, perhaps it's saying something about the writing or the time, et cetera, that the boys know how to masturbate. They are openly talking about these wet, sticky dreams. They know about, you know, how to jerk off in a circle or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
But the girls, as far as they go with female pleasure, other than Venla, which is another thing, all they do is kind of just talk about the crushes they have. And I almost wish the girls had a little... Or the trauma they've suffered. And then one of them dies, of course. And then one of them is ostracized from her community. And I wish there maybe was a moment in the show that allowed the girls to speak on their urges a little bit more. And it doesn't have to be to each other. It could be... you know,
I think that's absolutely fair.
But is that Touch Me? I don't know. It's unclear because none of the girls are speaking during Touch Me.
And they don't
they're all
solos.
Doing the choreography where they're touching themselves. So it's hard to say.
There are times when the singing, I feel like, isn't literal. You know, it's just communal energy that, you know, is representing what someone else is feeling. I had a talk with a female friend of mine about this like a few years ago where, and this is just her experience. So by no means does blank speak for all women, but we were talking about kind of, you know, masturbation. And she was like, it's a little more effort for women because it's so inward. And it's so sensitive and so complicated. Whereas with men, like, it's right there and it might take you a minute as a teenager to figure it out, but you figure it out pretty quickly. It takes, especially with no information at your fingertips, it's for like 19th century girls with no knowledge of what sexuality is, any feelings that they do have of horniness, they probably don't necessarily know how to express it just yet or how to handle themselves in any way, especially with the puritanical views of their society. Right. It's all just confusion. But I would like, I'm with you on this one, Connor. I feel like with My Junk, I would love it if that could sort of bleed into from crushes into like, you know, I'm feeling something else now. Like,
yeah, even if they just want to talk about kissing the boys or something, I don't know.
Caressing them, something about their bodies. Yeah, because it's all just, it's very piney and that's lovely. We've all been there, but like, I don't know. If you were alone with Melchior, Remy Zakin, who does she play? Anna? No, Taya.
Taya.
Taya, if you were alone with that radical Melchior Gabor, what would you do with him? Would you kiss him? Would you stroke his hair? Would you stroke his back? There's something.
You're giving me a tingle.
Oh my God. That's what I do. From afar only though, Connor, through a computer screen, never in person. When we meet in person, you're going to be like, oh, I'm straight now.
Well, you know, as we're talking about all these different iconic actors who have been in the roles, do either of you have like a favorite performance from Spring Awakening that you saw or maybe didn't see that you're like, oh my God, I love even like them on the cast album or in the bootleg or whatever?
Well, I did see the original and then I saw the revival. I remember really, and so actually fun fact, the other thing about the original company of Spring Awakening is for the majority of that first year, it was difficult to see the entire original company at the same time. Because they were young, because, you know, 8 shows a week is hard. And also because, you know, once the show finally got some success, opportunities were coming their way. A lot of people calling out left and right. So when I saw it pretty early in the run, Lauren Pritchard was out and Remy Zakin was out. And in their place were, respectively, Krista Rodriguez and Jen Damiano.
Oh, my goodness.
Slay though.
And then when I saw the revival, I saw Krista play Ilsa again. So it was really cool to see Krista play that role like 9 years apart, very differently.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed what she did in the revival. I also remember being really moved by Lily Cooper in the original, especially in Left Behind. And this is one of those things where it's like you do the setup in Act One. So all it takes is one moment on stage to pay out, which is when you find out in Act One, like, that Marta's the only one who finds Mark Stiefel cute and attractive. And like, it's just a little too shy to say anything about him. And
that
then
sad, soulful, sleepyhead Mark Stiefel.
Yeah. How can you even compare them? But when he dies and they're all sort of like paying their respects, there's a little bit of a longer moment for Marta because she's the only one who had a very specific feeling towards Mark that will never get any kind of resolution. And it's something about the way she, I remember, I think she like dropped the flower, something way she did it just like really spoke to me.
Wow. Ellen? I love that. My greatest experience with Spring Awakening was with the first national tour, and Christy Altomare played Vendla in the tour. And to me, she was graceful and naive and perfect. Mm-hmm. And I still have deliveries, like line deliveries of how she interpreted the role in my head to this day. And I'll never forget the scene where she realizes that she's pregnant and it's because of what she did with Melchior. Mm-hmm. That to me like still gives me chills to this day. And the moment where Venla says, like when she's asking Melchior to beat her in the first act and he's like, why? And she's like, I've never felt anything. Like, it's such a great line that, you know, she's so confused and wrapped up in herself of wanting to figure things out. But Christy, to me, was an early queen, an early big influence for me.
Connor?
She bodied that. I know. I was gonna say Christy. So let me think of like a more fun answer really quick. Well, the woman who played the adult women on the tour, Angela Reed?
Bassett.
Angela Bassett. Was so amazing as the adult women, like bodied that.
Yeah.
Bodied. But also, fun fact, Dylan and I went to Chicago to see the first national tour because a majority of the cast was leaving to, you know, they had done it for a year or whatever. So like Blake Bashoff was leaving, Ben Moss was leaving, etc. So I think Kyle Riabko was leaving and it was the guy from Degrassi coming in to do it, or maybe he had already left and he was new. But anyway, the Moritz replacement was Taylor Trench, who is one of my favorite theater actors, living theater actors, you know, and he was so naturally tapped into Moritz at his like very first performance. And I will honestly never forget seeing him. Oh, and Ben Fankhauser was Ernst, right, Dylan?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Ben of Newsies. So it was like really, I really loved Taylor too. And of course, Ben Moss, voice of an angel as Ernst, Steffi D giving iconic Canadian rasp as Ilsa. So I guess I'd throw those out there too.
Yeah, I had a friend who joined the company, I guess in the second year of the national tour. And we didn't get to see the tour because we were still in school. And she was a swinger ensemble, something like that. So like we, as a college kid, you don't like fly out to Philadelphia because your friend's going to be Venla for the weekend. Mm-hmm. But I remember when the tour closed, a bunch of the Spring Awakening girls did a concert at Laurie Beachman.
Yeah, I remember
and,
that.
Yeah, I think Julie Benko was there. Christina
Alabado. Yeah. Probably Chris Kiyopi.
Chris Kiyopi was definitely there. I think Kimiko Glenn also did it.
Yeah, she probably would have been. Claire Sparks might have been there.
Yeah, well, and because I know it was various girls from the tour at different points. So even Christy was there as well. And I remember when Christy became Sophie and Mamma Mia, I didn't know who she was, but her likeness was on the side of the Broadhurst. And my friend pointed to her and she's like, oh my God, it's Christy. I'm like, who is she? She's like, she was Venla before I joined the tour. So when Christy got Carrie, and then when she got Anastasia, I just knew her as, oh yeah, that Venla from the tour. So-and-so. And that's also how I knew about Taylor, was because Taylor, my friend, became very close on that tour. And I think Taylor actually came to see the production of Carousel that I directed at Emerson, because Kayla came back after she finished the tour, and her boyfriend at the time was my Billy Bigelow. So Taylor like came to see the whole thing.
What was Kayla's last name again?
Foster.
Yeah, I remember that she was a cast member.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She actually, I don't think she ever did go on for Venla. I think she got a put in and then never went on, but she did all the other
bummer.
Roles. Yeah.
Bummer.
We used to joke, we're like, it's a shame that, you know, America never got to see your boobs. But then she did, I think she was on The Deuce, where she played like a hustling sex worker. And we're like, well, now America has seen your boobs. She did it on
HBO. Wow. I think Christy might have done the full tour. I'm trying to remember if there was ever a Venla replacement.
I don't know.
On the tour.
Maybe there was. I don't know.
But the whole cast, I mean, think of like Lily Cooper, Tony nominee. Gideon Glick, Tony nominee. Matt Doyle, Tony winner. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've got Groff in there, nominated a few times. Like mm-hmm. John Gallagher won. Caitlin Kinnunen was in the replacement cast.
Alexandra Socha replacement cast.
Socha. Like,
yeah, Socha.
I mean, Julie Benko, like from the tour. And then Leah. I don't know. Like, it's just, it's really amazing. And Kimiko, of course, has had a robust theater and television career. And Andy, like everyone has really done exciting things. It's just, it's so cool. It is so cool.
Yeah. It's also really sweet how many of them have gone on to do shows with Michael Mayer again. I find that fun. Mm-hmm. Michael Mayer is really good about coming back to people that he enjoys. Okay.
Yeah. A lot of them did American Idiot right away. Like Brian Charles Johnson.
Half of them have done Little Shop of Horrors.
Now he's got them all through Little Shop.
Yep. And we have Julie and Leah with Funny Girl. It's all connected. Okay. There's so much. Honestly, we could keep talking about the show forever.
We're having so much fun, man.
I'm having a blast with you guys. But I did promise Connor that we would end a while ago, and we've gone way too far. So I'm just going to have to bring you guys back, and we're going to have to clear a whole evening.
Listen, I know. The invite is there. We'll have you on drama as well.
I want to give you all the juice that you're squeezing out of this. Let's call it an orange. What else are you dying to talk about?
God, I don't know. Jonathan Groff's ass. Okay.
Well, that's a whole podcast.
I think, ladies, we just started a podcast right here, right now. In addition to drama and Broadway Breakdown, we are going to start a podcast, and I'm going to pitch it to BPN, and it's just called Jonathan Groff's Ass. And we talk about everything but, Jonathan Groff's ass until the last 10 minutes. And then it's just new adjectives we can think of.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Just keep it fresh.
Yeah. And love. All the places you can see it. Spring Awakening, Bootleg, Looking, all the episodes and movie version of Looking, Taking Woodstock, Mindhunter. Yeah. Mindhunter. That boy knows that he's got a good peach and he's willing to show it off.
Mm-hmm. Mindhunter should have gotten the third season. And then, you know, he was just in Merrily. And although he is clothed the entire time, Connor did have a viral tweet about his ass. That it was shown to Jonathan himself.
You know what? I think I need to finally post it on Instagram. So when this episode drops, I will do it finally.
Please do, because I do not have Twitter, but I do have Instagram, and I'm an old man. I like visuals. I need bright, colorful photos. Yeah,
it's fair.
Do either of you have visions in your head of how you would like to do Spring Awakening? Do either of you fancy yourself directors?
You know, it's funny. I think at one point I would have wanted to have directed it, but I mentioned earlier that my boyfriend did it last year in Columbus, Ohio.
I'm sorry, Dylan, you have a boyfriend? You have a boyfriend?
Oh, yes.
Do you want to say it one more time?
Have I said it a lot?
Yeah. You said it like three times. I notoriously love to drag people on this podcast in relationships because I'm going to die alone. And it's the only comfort I get. Connor, do you have a boyfriend?
I don't want to mention it now because I don't want to be dragged.
Well,
no.
Fine. You don't.
But no.
Okay. You get to stay. Dylan.
I used to get a lot of heat for mentioning him on the podcast. No,
I love that you found love in a hopeless place. This world is terrible. So your boyfriend did it.
He was Han Chen. Yes. And that was fun. And I remember when I watched that production, there was a lot of things I think I would have done maybe differently, just having seen it with fresh eyes and seeing him in the show. And I think that there's a way to, you know, because people love to modernize the show and maybe change up the ending or different things like that. And I do have visions of how I think I would connect it to modern society that that I think is possible with the production.
I love that.
Yeah.
I just realized why I'm actually going to die alone, though, when you were telling that story. You're like, oh, I was watching my boyfriend play Han Chen. And I was like, if I was seeing a production of Spring Awakening and my boyfriend was playing Han Chen, I would turn to the person next to me during my junk and go, that's not how he usually jerks off.
I mean, it was fun. You know, I sat with my parents while they watched him jerk off. You know, it was very interesting.
Oh, God.
And again, I would tell my parents, don't worry, that's not how he does it in real life. And just like, must I troll the people I love in this world? Apparently, that's all I can do.
I don't know if this is an original thought, but I feel like there's somewhere in my brain the concept of having Spring Awakening being done in like an insane asylum, and then it ends and they're all locked up in the loony bin vibes.
It's not that it's an unoriginal thought. I don't know if anyone's thought of that for Spring Awakening. Also, why is my hair so weird? So there was an NYU production of Hair that did that.
Oh.
I want to do a production of Cats that's set in an insane asylum.
That makes sense.
Work.
And McCavity is the nurse Ratched who comes in to give everyone their pills and shots. And then at the end, Grizabella, to just lean into the theory everyone has about this show, that like Grizabella's not going anywhere. She just jumps off into the ocean. All the inmates set up a chair and a noose made out of their bed sheet. And they're sending Grizabella off to the heavyside layer, and they just hang her. And then all through the
macabre.
And then the naming of the cats is them just singing to the audience while Grizabella just swings there.
Oh my God.
That's like a little too dark for me after talking about this play that's so dark.
But then
when
the curtain call happens, she just pops her head right back up. And she's able
Oh, that's
to,
cute though.
She gets herself out of the noose and she does a nice big bow.
It's very, very, you know, communal at the end.
It is very communal. We're all cats in some way.
What would you do with your production
of Spring Awakening?
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like what I might do, it's such a visual thing. I hate being the kind of, I never considered myself a director, really. I directed in college and it was sort of like food poisoning. The production turned out well, but it was such an awful experience getting the show up that I was like, never again. And I'm actually doing some musical staging for the New York City Gay Men's Chorus that I'm a part of. We have a concert next week. If either of you are in town for it, I can get you a ticket because I'm, you know, on the production team for this. But I did some staging for them for a few of the solo numbers and they went over quite well. And I was like, maybe I could do this again. I don't know. It's been long enough.
Love it.
Eating chicken after 13 years. Thank you. So if I did Spring Awakening, and I don't want to think like a director who only thinks in visuals, but I feel like I would start it probably very communal with the audience. Like everyone's sort of sitting in, you know, different spots. It wouldn't necessarily be all proscenium, maybe in the round. And it would be very all the lights on, like all the work lights on, all that stuff. And then sort of as the show continued, it would get a little more theatrically lit and darker. Until we get to act two where all the shit hits the fan. Actually, no. Until at the end of act one with the sex scene where all the lights would go out and then they come back up and it's like fully theatrical after that.
That's cool.
Yeah, I like
just
that.
Sort of like the world kind of collapsing in on you, you know? I steal that from Carousel, which everyone's heard me talk about this scene transition, so fuck off. I'm going to say it one more time. You can watch the video on YouTube, but it doesn't do it justice. In Carousel, in the 94, and the best thing that's ever happened to Broadway ever, and yes, I am backing it up with science. They do it on a hill. They do that whole scene on a hill rather than on a bench. And you've been to the Beaumont at Lincoln Center, right?
Oh, yeah.
And so you know, like, it's got that thrust, and then it's got that deep stage.
Yes.
And so what they did at the end of the scene with the blossoms and all that shit, Sally Murphy, remember her name, she's popping up in a second, and Michael Hayden, they do their kiss, and they get into, like, this bear hug. It's not cute. It's, like, it's they're just holding on to each other for dear life. And then that hill, that green turtle shell, moved to the back of the Beaumont stage as all the lights started to go down, except for one spotlight on them as they kept holding on to each other. And the spotlight got tighter and tighter and tighter as the hill went further back and further back. So they just looked like they were drowning in darkness until the final note, and then the light went out. I'm like, that is a beautiful image, and it's a great metaphor for their relationship. Because even though it's toxic, they hold on to each other because let go and there's nothing but darkness. Now, that's beautiful in theory. I know a few people in this world who have similar mentalities about their relationship, and I can just tell you, those of us who know them, those you've known, we're all sitting there being like, honey, get off the hill. Get out of the theater. There are other theaters.
who directed that?
Nicholas Heitner.
Oh, great. Oh, wow. Okay.
I believe Sir Nicholas Heitner. Yes. Who's now the artistic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who's now the artistic director of the Bridge Theater doing Guys and Dolls, which was that playing when you two were in London?
No, it didn't. Originally, we were supposed to be there now and it was playing or started this week, but it was not playing.
I didn't realize that you two were so homophobic to yourselves. Just deny yourself.
We changed because we ultimately did get tickets to Streetcar at the Alamo.
Mezcal. Yeah.
It's. Yeah. Oh, I want to say this as well. This is how you know I've listened to your pod. It is Mezcal. Paul Mezcal.
It is Mezcal.
It's Mezcal. It is Mezcal. It is Mezcal. Okay. Yes. I thought so.
Yes. Because, yes, you had a moment with each other, like, Mezcal, Mezcal. And I'm sitting there being like, I'm going to be able to tell them in 90 minutes.
Thank you.
You're like, thank you for telling me this 5 weeks after we recorded that. Yeah. I love it when I record episodes 2 months ago and then I release it 2 months later. People DM me, they're like, you said this and this is what you were asking. I'm like, thank you, I found that out in the last 2 months since I recorded
it. When will this come out? Sorry, I'm getting all busy.
Soon. This is coming out next week. So this, we're recording this on the 8th. This is coming out on the 16th.
Do you want to hear something crazy? I saw Spring Awakening on March 8th in 2009.
Me too. I was there.
So this is the 14th anniversary of you seeing Spring Awakening.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I feel like we were on stage, Dylan, were we not?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't do on stage. I don't love being on stage because then I feel like I have to perform a little bit, even though no one's watching me. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Well, I thought the same. And then a friend of ours was in the audience while we were on stage. And he was like, you weren't rocking out during Bitch. And I was like, oh, okay.
But see, that's the kind of stuff that makes me nervous. I'm like, people are going to look at me, even if only for a second. I saw View from the Bridge on stage, and luckily the way that whole thing was designed, no one really looks at you, but still every now and then I was like, half the Lyceum Theater can see me. I must stand with posture.
Yeah. With Russell Tovey.
With Russell. Yes. So with Russell Tovey, the talk about, speaking of Jonathan Groff, that is a couple of sex scenes between those two that, sprung my awakening. Now, okay. Jens, this has been an absolute pleasure. We do have to wrap this up because, Connor, you've been lovely, but I'm gonna release you now because you have work to do.
It's tragic. It's almost as tragic as aspects of Spring Awakening, but ultimately it was so fun. I learned a lot and I got to geek out about a musical that, honestly, not to make it full circle, was a ring of keys for me in terms of getting into the business. I remember seeing the show and being like, oh my God, they're so close to me in age. Mm-hmm. They're participating in the arts in a huge way. Let me go watch Jonathan Groff's Broadway.com backstage tour again and again and again and again and again and learn everything. You know, it really was this amazing to be going through puberty and experiencing my own questions about life and what I'm interested in and my sexuality while watching it happen on stage in a musical was such a strange and perfect, fateful timing that I almost felt like, how am I getting this so well as a kid, you know, a teen, but also theater goers everywhere are also enjoying this and feeling it. Like that's powerful art to me. So that's why, part of why I love Spring Awakening.
Yeah. That's the power of musical theater. It touches on something that's not necessarily in your head. It's in your heart. It's chemical. Mm. Music is something we can all relate to.
Yeah. Period.
Period. Says Dylan, any final parting words on Spring Awakening?
Oh, it's definitely in my top three forever and always. I will always buy a ticket to see it whenever it's performed. And thank you so much for having us. You know, we talk about it a lot on our show, but never in this depth. We're usually just trying to get like memories from the cast and whatnot. So this was lovely. Matt, you're so good at what you do.
Dylan. And you love it. You love it. You can tell that you love it. And that's what I love about your podcast. You love what you're talking about.
Thank you very much. I gotta say, this has probably been the most polite I've been about a show in a while, even shows that I love. But you know, like when we get in sort of like the nitty gritty stuff and we talk about, you know, some of the backstage stuff, I have friends on this pod who I love and I'm going to have them back on again. But we get bitchy and we make like snarky comments, but we do it usually lovingly, like Adam Ellsbury and I in the Rent episode with our Daphne Rubin Vega impressions. But like it's coming from two gays who have devoured that cast album. So we just know every minutia of her performance. Get a light. But.
It's like how I would have done my Alice Ripley impression had we done a Next to Normal episode together, you know?
Well, no, you said it. Here we go. you're on the air. Dylan McDowell, will you come back on to do Next to Normal?
Oh my goodness. I would be honored.
Connor?
Can I come back for something different alone?
I was actually going to say, first of all, I was going to make a joke and be like, Connor, you want to leave now? But I didn't think of that fast enough. This has been amazing. I would gladly take you both at the same time or separately. And I don't mean that sexually, but don't I? But yes, we'll work out the logistics. But yes, you both are going to come back on for this series. And awesome. I have Dylan on record as saying that I'm going to be on Drama. I may not be as famous as Matt Doyle, but I am more famous now than Matt Shingledecker. So there we go. I'm in between the two Spring Awakening Matts.
And you got to end on a snarky note, which I am gagged by. I'm obsessed with that.
Thank you. Before we close out. Oh, shit. We got to do this. We have a game.
Right.
It's the same game, different names. I don't know if either of you made it to the end of either of the episodes.
Yeah.
You okay, great. So you know. But for the listeners out there, we have 6 degrees of Sally Murphy and Who Lives, Who Dies, Janine Tesori. They are the same game, which is to say that they are 6 degrees of both women. We have to find 6 degrees from the original production of Spring Awakening to Sally Murphy and as well to Janine Tesori. Janine Tesori is fucking easy. Now, you can use the entire original Broadway cast, no replacements. And you can use the entire original production team. I can help you with Sally Murphy. Janine Tesori is actually pretty easy if you just look at production team.
Totally. Do we go from Janine backwards?
You can go however you want, love.
Does it have to be six or can it be just one?
It could just be one. I mean, if you want to like try to make it fun, you can
yeah,
try
we'll
to
make
expand
it fun.
Because there's a one and done right there. Which
well,
Dylan
Michael Mayer, obviously.
Which one?
Michael Mayer and Janine Tesori. Yeah.
Yes, with Thoroughly Modern Millie.
What about Michael Cerveris?
Well, he wasn't in the original production.
Oh, okay. But involved.
But I mean, that's also a one and done.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, okay, okay.
Okay, okay,
well,
okay.
Oh, I have one. Oh, this is fun. Okay.
Okay.
It's pretty close, though. But John Gallagher Jr. was in the original play of Kimberly Akimbo. And Kimberly Akimbo was written by David Lindsay Hubert, and David Lindsay Hubert is working with Janine Tesori on Kimberly Akimbo, the Broadway show now.
Absolutely. And Shrek, so that also works. You also have John Gallagher Jr. in Rabbit Hole by David Lindsay Hubert.
DLA, mm-hmm. His Pulitzer.
Yep. Yeah, and yes, indeedy. That absolutely works. Sally Murphy. Now, I'm assuming you guys don't know Sally Murphy's credits like I do, because I am the one Sally Murphy superstan. I saw Downstate twice. Sally Murphy, let me give you some of her Broadway credits. We have the 94 Carousel with Audra. We have the Lacusa Wild Party. We have the Fiddler on the Roof with Alfred Molina. Wink, wink. We have August Osage County. We have the Minutes. But there's an immediate one and done.
Right. Leah Michelle being in that Fiddler.
The Fiddler that had two Jews in the entire company. Speaking of Laura Michelle Kelly.
I'm sure
she wasn't as well. I'm sure there are more Jewish people in that production, but when it opened, the joke was like it was the least Jewish fiddler of all time.
Is Alfred Molina Jewish?
I don't think he is.
He gives Jewish energy.
But also, like, that production was just very pristine and, like, cold. There was another joke that, like, the set looked like it came from West Elm. It looked like a West Elm set is what people often said about the production. Because it was just, like, very pretty to look at. That's not a slight. That was just what the talk was at the time. I'm trying to think if we could do one more.
Okay, Mia Michelle was in Ragtime.
Yes, with Audra.
With Audra.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, that was too easy. That was too quick.
With Sally Murphy. Okay, wait. So...
I wish I could extend it a little.
So how about this? I'm gonna have you guys challenge me on this one.
Okay.
Give me a Spring Awakening person, and then we could also connect it back. Lea Michele Ragtime, directed by Frank Galati, who directed Sally Murphy in Grapes of Wrath. But we have Sally Murphy in Grapes of Wrath, Carousel, Lacusa Wild Party, Alfred Molina Fiddler on the Roof, August Osage County, The Minutes. Those are the Sally Murphy credits. Give me somebody from Spring Awakening, and then give me a Sally Murphy credit, and I'm going to try to connect the dots.
Okay, we're going to definitely do Wild Party for Sally Murphy.
I knew I liked you.
Yeah, that's because I think that has like a really robust cast as well.
It also fucks so hard, Dylan.
Are you a Lacusa?
I have done Lippas. I have done. Okay. It is not fun to be in Lippas unless you are the main four.
Okay.
And even then,
you're always rooting for the underdog. So this is
always rooting for the underdog. And also, uh-huh. I'm sorry, Toni Collette. Come on.
I know. Eartha Kitt.
Eartha Kitt. Mandy Patinkin, Mark Kudish, Norm Lewis. I could go on, but I won't.
I chose the credit for Sally, and Connor's going to choose the Spring Awakening cast member. It doesn't have to be original, Connor. Or does it? Does it have to be original?
It does, but if you want to make it fun, we can do
tour. No, do original.
Or it could be
Do you hear my hissing heater?
I do. I thought that was just your lisp. Ba-da-bunch.
I'm going to be random as hell, and no offense to this performer.
Do it.
Lauren Pritchard.
Oh, fuck you. Oh, fuck you.
Do you want me to change?
What?
You want me to change?
Well, I don't know if she's done any other theater, has she? Because she's mostly like she mostly does like indie music.
Yeah.
She now goes by a different name, in fact.
She goes by a different name. How about I give you, let's go with Lily Cooper.
Oh!
This is a fun one.
This is a fun one. Okay. 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 Lily Cooper was in POTUS. I don't know where I'm going yet, but I feel like there are options here.
Uh-huh.
POTUS. Also had, motherfucker, had Julie White.
Mm-hmm.
Julie White was in the play Gary with Nathan Lane and Christine Nielsen. Directed by George C. Wolfe, who directed The Wild Party with Sally Murphy, Bang Bang Boom.
Wow. That was good. You're good at this game.
Bang Bang Bong.
Bing Bang Bong, Sing Sang Song. In my defense, Connor, I have done this quite a few times now. And I'm usually
You're a Melchior. You're a regular Melchior, aren't you?
Well, especially with Sally, because I do the game and everyone's like, I think I could figure out Janine. I don't know Sally. And I'm like, this is my ploy to get people to know Sally Murphy better. She's the best Julie Jordan. Anyway, Dylan, Connor, where can people find you if you want them to find you?
Oh, yeah, yes. Come and knock on our door. We're at The Drama Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. We're at The Drama Pod on TikTok. And you can also find us. Connor and I respond to all DMs. Even the naughty ones. I'm at Dylan McDowell and Connor is at Connor McDowell.
Especially the naughty ones.
And it's McDowell is spelled M-A-C-D-O-W-E-L-L.
Guys, this has been amazing. I've really had the best time. And I also say if you want to reach out to them, you can email them on the drama website. They do answer to those emails. I can confirm.
Yes.
If you're a shark, sharks come back and reply to you. Guys, if you want to follow me, I'm on Instagram only at Matt Koplik, usual spelling. I have to make this statement again, unfortunately. Please don't go to Facebook because A, I don't use it, but also it's only there for my family. So it's not that like I find it a violation, like, you know, telling a Spring Awakening cast member, you know, where they went on vacation, but I just don't respond. So just don't do it. Instagram, I will respond to DMs there. I post theater reviews. I actually will be writing my Danson review around the time that this episode comes out, and Ooh. Bad Cinderella after that. For the first time this entire series, I know what the next episode's going to be. I've done this whole thing out of order. We have one more episode coming up, and then we're going to go on a bit of a hiatus.
Oh.
But the episode is going to be in a very special bonus episode that wasn't on the roster, but it meets our criteria for off-Broadway transfers and harks back to a past series on someone we might have just mentioned, Janine Tesori. We are covering Kimberly Akimbo with, drumroll please, for the first time in 2 years, My Father. My father is coming to the city. I am taking him to see Kimberly Akimbo, my fourth time, his first. And Boo Boo has agreed to come back on the podcast and discuss his thoughts. So
that is a treat.
I think so. He's not famous, but I had enough people ask if he was going to come back on, especially because my mom did Torch Song Trilogy. They were like, well, you got to bring Boo Boo back on. So I've listened to the listeners and Boo Boo's coming. If you like
and
the
what
podcast,
a special show to see with a parent as well.
Yeah, I saw it. Literally 2 weeks ago with my mom, and we both cried, but it's the show does it to you. Have you seen it yet, Dylan?
That's my favorite show, the new show of the season. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's amazing. Connor, you've seen it, I'm assuming?
Yes. Yeah, I've seen it 4 times.
Have you really?
Well, it's actually interesting to talk about Kimberly and Spring Awakening because they were both Atlantic transfers.
Sure were.
You know, of shows that were plays first and moved on, small casts. I don't know. Very interesting. But I'm on the advertising team for Kimberly Akimbo. So everyone should definitely go see it.
Wait a second. You might know another friend of mine. We'll talk about this off mic.
Adam Ellsbury? You mentioned Adam Ellsbury. Yeah. I work with him at the same agency.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
So that's why you were at Chuck last night.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. That's amazing. Oh, we're all going to have to get together soon. I didn't know that we all had so much in common, you guys. If I had known, we would have been friends 10 years ago.
Oh,
the timing was everything for this special moment.
It
gets better.
This really was special. If you like the podcast, guys, give us a nice 5-star rating or a review. It always helps with the algorithm. And that's it for now. Gentlemen, we close out every episode with a Broadway diva. We like to have that diva be related to our show. We try not to do doubles, but we're getting to the point where we kind of start having to. Who should we close out with today? Who would you like?
I mean, have you done Leah in Funny Girl yet?
Not in Funny Girl. Have we done Leah at all? Back when I had a co-host, John, he was very anti-Leah, so we never did her. But since I've rebranded and made it all about me, just like Beth Level, I don't think we've done Leah. So yeah, and I didn't just get assigned to write her review. My review for the cast album with her just got released. So that's actually apropos. We'll do Leah and Funny Girl. Which track? Do we do Star? Do we do Parade? Cornet Man, which is a secretly killer track.
Connor has to choose because Connor has a particular favorite.
It's People.
It's People.
It is sublime.
It is a wonderful People. See, she makes me almost understand the lyrics. Almost.
Amazing.
All right. Thank you so much, guys. And thank you for listening, everybody. Take us away, Leah. Bye.
Son who needs people.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode
of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.